weeks or months of viewing this content day in, day in and out, they started to develop long-term mental health consequences.
The Moderators starts this afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And this is BBC Radio 4. Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Monday, the 11th of November. This is Today with Johnny Diamond and Amol Rajan.
The headlines this morning. Donald Trump has reportedly told President Putin not to escalate the war in Ukraine during a private phone call soon after his US election victory. We'll speak to our Russia editor, Stephen Rosenberg, and the Defence Secretary, John Healey, at 8:10. And Sir Keir Starmer is set to hold talks with President Macron before attending Armistice Day commemorations in Paris.
Also in today's programme, the Archbishop of Canterbury has rejected calls for him to resign over his handling of a major abuse scandal. We'll hear from one of Justin Welby's critics. Shakespeare in schools is putting a generation of kids off English literature, so says a teacher at one London sixth form.
My dear Lady Disdain... Are you yet living?
Should it be shuffled off the syllabus for good? And...
dancing their couple's choice. Chris McCausland and Diane Busby.
Fresh from a groundbreaking performance on Saturday night, we'll speak to Chris McCausland, Strictly's first ever blind contestant, as he prepares for the glittering Blackpool Ballroom. The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
A clearer picture may be emerging of Donald Trump's approach to the war in Ukraine, with him reportedly issuing a direct warning to President Putin not to escalate the conflict. According to the Washington Post, the president-elect reminded the Russian leader of the sizable American military presence in Europe. Mr. Trump's election victory has raised concerns about the future of the war. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports.
There's been uncertainty about Donald Trump's approach to the war in Ukraine, but it now appears discussions started only hours after his election victory. According to the Washington Post, the president-elect spoke to Vladimir Putin on Thursday and urged a speedy resolution to the conflict. Mr. Trump's spokesman hasn't denied the reports, which follow a campaign pledge to end the nearly three-year-long war within a day. Mr. Trump is known to be sceptical about the continued supply of billions of dollars of U.S. aid for Ukraine, but the White House is urging the incoming administration not to turn its back on the country in the face of growing Russian aggression.
The war in Ukraine and any shift in American policy are expected to be high on the agenda when Sir Keir Starmer holds talks with President Macron in Paris. The pair will meet before attending Armistice Day commemorations near the Champs-Élysées to mark the anniversary of the end of the First World War. After his brief stop in Paris, Sir Keir Starmer will travel to Baku in Azerbaijan for the COP29 climate talks. There's uncertainty about how Donald Trump's return to the White House will impact international discussions on tackling climate change. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, is at the conference.
Negotiators want to set a new goal for how much cash richer countries will provide to help poorer countries transition away from fossil fuels and become more resilient to climate change. The total currently stands at $100 billion a year. Developing countries and climate activists say it should be more than $1 trillion a year. Getting a commitment on that scale was always going to be a huge challenge. But with the US set to pull out of the game, it will be even harder.
Leaders of Arab and Muslim states are gathering for an emergency summit in Saudi Arabia, where they'll discuss the conflicts in Gaza and Lebanon. Delegates want to see an immediate end to Israel's military action against Hamas and Hezbollah. The details of a new law to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales are expected to be published early this week. The Labour MP behind the draft legislation has said it will be the strictest of its kind in the world. Opponents say the safest law is the one currently in place. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
The proposed legislation is expected to run to more than 40 pages and is being published after lengthy consultation with experts. Kim Leadbeater, the Labour MP for Spen Valley, who's bringing the private members' bill, says it will, in her words, contain the strictest protections and safeguards of any legislation anywhere in the world. Of the dozens of MPs I've spoken to, many support the change, but many others have concerns about the impact on disabled people and whether it could open the door to future changes. There are also lots of MPs yet to make up their mind, with some holding open meetings to ask constituents for their views.
The charity Asthma and Lung UK says failing to prevent, diagnose and treat lung diseases such as asthma, COPD and cystic fibrosis is silently suffocating the NHS. Analysts say it's carried out. It suggests respiratory conditions were responsible for 1 in 8 hospital admissions in England last year. The government says it will support the health service to increase capacity to meet demand. Dr. Ian Higginson from the Royal College of Emergency Medicine says winter is a particularly bad time.
We obviously try and prioritise patients in order of clinical need, and often those who are breathless are afforded a high priority. But even so, once we've started work on them, we're often still having to treat them in corridors and in inappropriate treatment spaces because our departments are absolutely full at the moment.
The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has said he would be willing to call a vote of confidence in his minority government before Christmas, a step that could pave the way for a snap election sooner than he'd wanted. Opposition parties have been demanding a faster timetable to end the country's political turmoil. In a television interview last night, Mr. Scholz said he wasn't clinging on to his job after the collapse of his governing coalition. The Conservative leader, Kelly Badenoch, is likely to be asked about her decision to sack the former chairman of the Post Office, Henry Staunton, when she was business secretary during an appearance at the Post Office inquiry today. The BBC has found out that earlier this year she put pressure on Fujitsu, the company that made the faulty Horizon IT system, to provide early compensation. Tom Beale reports.
The government has a compensation fund for wrongly prosecuted post office sub-postmasters. But Fujitsu has also been facing questions about how much it should pay victims. Its European CEO, Paul Patterson, has said the company has a moral obligation to compensate them, though not until after the public inquiry concludes in 2025. The reply to a Freedom of Information request revealed that in March, the then-business secretary, Kemi Badenoch, told the firm's Japanese chief executive that an early gesture of compensation would be helpful, but there was no follow-up to this meeting. Fujitsu said it would consider the findings of the inquiry and work with the UK government on appropriate actions.
A former GB para-athlete is aiming to become the first disabled person to ski to the South Pole without any kind of support. Johnny Huntington, who's completely paralysed from the neck down on his left side, will ski for more than 500 miles. He said he was excited to take on what he called the ultimate test.
Thanks very much, Alan. It is 7 minutes past six. Let us find out the weather for the day, perhaps for the early part of the week, from Sarah Keith-Lucas at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Sarah.
Good morning to you, Johnny, and we've been waiting long enough, but finally we're going to see some sunshine out there today and really for much of the week ahead as well. We've still got high pressure dominating our weather, so it's looking dry, it's looking settled, but all that low cloud, mist and murk that's been with us for a couple of weeks now is clearing away towards the south. We've still got the remnants of a weather front sitting across parts of southern, particularly southwest England, so a little bit cloudy and drizzly first thing in the south and southwest, but that should clear away towards the south fairly quickly. We'll just see a little bit more cloud then working in across Northern Ireland and Scotland at times, bringing the odd shower to the north of Scotland, but they should largely ease away. Also, just the chance of a rogue shower around the east coast of England, particularly North Yorkshire, down towards Norfolk as well. But for most of us, you will be looking dry once again. And we've got a lot of high cloud across our skies this morning, but that should thin and break, so more sunshine developing into the afternoon. Temperatures around 10 to 12 for most, but could be 13 or 14 in the southwest. It is a little cooler and fresher than it has been, but we've got the sunshine to compensate. So overnight tonight, we're looking at another clear and dry night, a bit of mist and fog through many central areas in particular, and lows between 2 to 5 overnight tonight. And then into tomorrow, we've got mist and fog clearing away, but like today, plenty of sunshine developing. Tomorrow, just the chance of a bit more cloud and a few showers, though, for the southeast of England and East Anglia.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. Lovely to hear about the sunshine. It's just coming up to 9 minutes past six. Let's take you through what's in the papers and websites. The Daily Telegraph says Sir Keir Starmer and President Macron, as you've just been hearing, are planning to, as the paper says, thwart efforts by Donald Trump to scale back US support for Ukraine. According to government insiders, the British and French leaders will discuss whether President Biden can be persuaded before he leaves the White House to give Kyiv permission to fire long-range Storm Shadow missiles deep into Russia. According to the paper, there are hopes Mr. Biden will approve the measure in an attempt to secure his foreign policy legacy. And it's worth saying I'll put some of these issues to the Defence Secretary, John Healey, when he joins us at 10 past 8.
The Times also leads on the talks between the Prime Minister and the French President. It says Donald Trump's pledge to impose blanket tariffs of up to 20% on imports will be on the agenda. The Guardian focuses on the symbolism of Sir Keir attending the French Armistice Day service, describing it as a pointed show of European solidarity after Mr. Trump's election.
According to the Eye, civil servants have warned that the government's plans to smash people smuggling gangs will have little impact on channel crossings and on reducing illegal migration to the UK. Insiders have told the paper that department officials were underwhelmed by the strategy set out by the Prime Minister last week, and experts have said that smugglers will adapt. A Home Office spokesperson says the government will stop at nothing to dismantle people smuggling gangs and bring them to justice.
The Guardian reports that the government is looking at ways to provide more funding to hospices because of fears many are at risk of closure due to the rise in employers' national insurance, which was announced in the budget last month. Whitehall sources say it's not a done deal, but a number of options are being considered. Separately, the Eye reports that one in five of the UK's 200 hospices have already made service cuts or are planning to, even before the national insurance charge comes into effect.
Most of the papers mark Remembrance Sunday. Many feature photographs of the Princess of Wales, who is gradually returning to royal duties after her cancer treatment at yesterday's service at the Cenotaph in London. Show of resilience, says the Daily Express. Solemn duty, says Metro. Kate's salute to heroes is the Sun's headline. The Daily Mail says her determination to attend Remembrance events over the weekend demonstrated the importance the royal family attach to commemorating the fallen.
The Telegraph says at the weekend the police had to be called to deal with hundreds of bargain hunters when the French kitchenware company Le Creuset had a sale at a warehouse in Hampshire. Shoppers are said to have queued for hours. The People says people were tempted by the more palatable prices for the brand's casserole dishes, which cost a fortune, and baking trays they normally sell for hundreds of pounds. Officers had to be brought in when several miles of cars trying to get to the site were reported. Stop giggling, Amol. The Telegraph sums up the word pandemonium. I'm sorry about a pun so early in the
morning. Don't pretend you weren't in that queue. I saw you there. Pictures, evidence has accumulated.
I was nowhere near the site. Honest God.
All right. 12 minutes past six.
Yeah, the 29th annual UN Climate Change Conference, COP29, kicks off today in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan. There's already a fair amount of noise around this gathering because at least one of the host officials seems to be using it to do some oil and gas deals on the side. Amongst the questions for those gathering in Baku might be, what's the point, given the re-election of Donald Trump, who's not keen on the idea of climate change, something he calls a hoax, and even less keen on paying for it? Justin Roller, our climate editor, is in Baku at COP29. Morning, Justin. How much of a shadow does Donald Trump's re-election throw over this particular gathering?
Well, let's be honest, he throws a big shadow. I mean, he doesn't take office until the 20th of January, and Biden has sent a negotiating team here to Baku, but President-elect Trump will not be bound, of course, to anything it agrees at COP29. That means the team isn't just a lame duck, it's a dead duck, according to one climate expert. They can commit to whatever they like, but countries like China unlikely to want to. The US team can commit to whatever they want, but if Trump is just going to ignore it, then it creates a kind of a space for countries like China perhaps not to step up and be as ambitious as they could. But there is another way of looking at it, which is there is a huge opportunity for countries to take leadership on the climate issue, and one of the main candidates there would be China. So there's a question about whether we'll see it step forward and talk about generous financial settlements to developing countries here in the UN process, which would be a really significant new development if it did that, or will it, as I say, just hide behind the shadow of Trump and dial down its kind of climate ambition. China, of course, hugely invested in the transition in terms of, you know, its dominance of all the main renewable technologies. So it has a huge interest, of course, in the rest of the world transitioning to clean energy.
Justin, China may be hugely invested, but not so hugely invested that its premier, Xi Jinping, is coming. And he is one of a rather long list of rather large countries that aren't sending their heads of state or government to this. Is that important? Is that a marker of whether or not this meeting will be a success?
Look, it is important. If countries send their leaders here, it shows a commitment to the process. It does matter. I mean, what the organisers, the Azerbaijani team organising this, say is, listen, we've got 100 leaders, and Sir Keir Starmer among them, who are coming. But you're absolutely right. The Chinese president isn't coming. The European Union president isn't coming. Obviously, US president isn't coming. France, India, Brazil, Japan, Mexico, lots of big countries aren't sending their leaders here. Now, the defence would be, I think, that this is quite a technical discussion. It's a discussion about money, and it's going to be very difficult. In fact, there's already a kind of block has been, a spanner has been thrown into the works with China calling into question the European carbon border adjustment mechanism, which attempts to charge a levy on imports of high carbon goods from abroad. Developing countries are saying that's not fair. So there is already a kind of a potential block to negotiations right at the beginning. But look, it doesn't mean the negotiations, there won't be progress. But you know, look, of course it's significant that countries aren't sending their leaders here.
Justin, thank you very much indeed. Justin Rowlatt, our climate editor at Baku at the COP29, will speak to the former head of COP, Alok Sharma, Lord Sharma, just before 8 o'clock.
It's 6:15. Sir Keir Starmer is heading to Paris today for Armistice Day commemorations near the Champs-Élysées, marking the anniversary of the end of the First World War. Hugh Schofield is our Paris correspondent and joins us now. Hugh, plenty on the agenda for these bilaterals with President Macron and also the newish French Prime Minister Michel Barnier, who we all remember, and Starmer will be meeting him too.
Yeah, indeed, Emil. It'll kick off shortly with a breakfast meeting with Michel Barnier, the Prime Minister, at the ambassador's residence. A reminder, of course, that nowadays, if you come to France, you have to deal with two leaders. It's a kind of double-headed executive now. And though Macron very much still takes the lead on foreign matters, on domestic matters, budgets, it's Barnier, and it's very noticeable here in France how Macron has been eclipsed in the recent weeks and months by his prime minister. So yes, and then of course talks with Macron, which will focus inevitably, I think, primarily on the Trump prospect, and trade, as the Times are saying, the trade and security being the top issues. Obviously the EU and the UK are now different entities, so they can't exactly coordinate, but they will want to know, I think, what each other is up to in terms of planning as Trump prepares to take office in January. And if he does clamp down these tariffs on goods from Europe and the UK, then will there be retaliation from the EU and UK, and on security, of course, which chimes with the day's real meaning, which is about the sacrifice of the wars and so on. There will be, of course, focus on the prospects for Ukraine and for European defence. Is there going to be a big boost to European defence building and British investment in defence in the months ahead, with the prospect of America pulling back fully from the continent?
Indeed. Hugh Schofield in Paris, watching that closely for us all day, I'm sure. Thank you very much indeed.
It is 17 minutes past six. More pressure on Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, over national insurance hikes. We'll talk about the politics of that later, but right now it's pub and restaurant bosses warning the Chancellor that tax rises in last month's budget will, their words, unquestionably cause closures and job losses. Will Bain is with us to go through that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Johnny. Morning, Amal. Yeah, as you guys were going through in the newspaper headlines, well, retailers as well, signing this coordinated letter over the weekend warning about what the impact of that potential rise in employers' national insurance contributions could be. Kate Nichols is the boss of UK Hospitality, the trade group which coordinated the letter, and is with us now. Kate, morning.
Good morning to you.
Just spell out then what you're seeing already, I suppose.
Well, what we're seeing already is businesses having to make some very tough decisions about how to deal with the extra costs that were imposed across the budget, and that surprise halving of the NIC threshold, meaning that far more workers across the hospitality sector in particular are brought within the tax regime, and a 75% increase in the jobs tax for those who were working 20 hours or less. So very significant additional costs coming through, businesses therefore having to look at how how they deal with that. 95% of them saying they are going to cut investment in the high street, and a similar proportion that they're going to have to increase price. But more worryingly, 85% saying they're going to have to cut hours and staff, and a third of the sector operating at or below break even. For those smaller businesses, it's calling into question their viability going forward.
And so are you seeing that already? The cut to hours, the cut to staff, is that happening already in anticipation of this?
It's not happening now, but people are in the process of planning it. People will have to make those decisions ahead of the increase coming in April in order to manage costs. But we are seeing businesses already starting to fail. This is the tipping point for them, who many of them have struggled for the last 2 years to recover post-COVID.
I appreciate there's been a lot of pressure on the industry over that period, as you say. But is there really nothing between now and April that they could do? You know, find it, squeeze out a bit more efficiency and a bit more upselling, I don't know, bring AI into doing their rotas or whatever, or booking systems, those kind of things.
I think if you bear in mind that this is a sector that was closed for 2 years during COVID, has then dealt with the energy crisis, food price inflation and cost of living, it's cut to the bone. People have squeezed margins as much as they are able to. And therefore, that's why you're seeing this impact on prices, on investment and on jobs. People will, of course, be looking to make savings, and they will, of course, be looking to make efficiencies as much as possible. We're trying to insulate our consumers from price increases, but there's no getting away from the fact that a £3.5 billion tax increase coming through in the budget, in particular that halving of the threshold on NICs, which disproportionately hits the sector. 66% of our workforce work part-time. Those are the workers most affected. We're doing everything we can to protect jobs and hours, but there are going to be some challenges. And automation, investment in AI, comes at the expense of human jobs.
Is that the concern then? Not actually the raising of the rate itself, but that threshold, that move down from when you have to start paying it to £5,000.
Yes, that is the key focus for us. I think most businesses have factored in that there was going to be an increase in the NI threshold. That in itself is expensive, but it's manageable. But for our sector, the halving of the threshold at which it applies is four times as impactful as the increase in the rate. And so that's the big challenge that we've got. For a worker employed 20 hours or less, their tax rate has gone up 75%.
And is that where you're negotiating with the government now, between now and obviously this sort of beginning its life as a bill?
Yes, that's what we're pushing the government to look again. We understand the government needs to balance the books. We understand that there are challenges in the public sector finances, and we need to protect public services, and we want to play our part in that. But we're asking her to look again at where it's hitting disproportionately on the hospitality sector and the high street, in order to protect jobs, growth and investment across that vital segment of the economy.
Kate, thanks so much for your time. Kate Nichols there, the Chief Executive of the Trade Group UK Hospitality. Well, as we were hearing just a moment ago from Justin Rolak, COP29 has gone underway in Azerbaijan today. And already, as Justin was saying, been plenty of controversy about not only the presence of big oil and gas bosses at the conference, but the lack of big leaders from around the world. One of those who is attending, though, is Mathios Rigas, Chief Executive of the £1.8 billion FTSE 250 listed energy company Energy. And Mathios, morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
There was that phrase, wasn't there, that Justin Rolak used a minute ago, that someone had told him that this wasn't so much a lame duck conference as a dead duck conference. Is there any point in people attending?
I disagree with that general statement. I think the reality that we're facing is that everybody should be attending those conferences. This is not an exclusive discussion. This should be an inclusive discussion. We should have global leaders, policymakers, oil and gas companies, and you know, you may ask, what does an oil and gas company have to do in a climate conference? Well, the reality that we're facing is that we need to work together, not against each other, to find solutions to the challenges that
have
the world
people
is
been working together, though? The very big energy firms, we see it every time we have their financial results here on the programme, seem to be stepping away or setting to one side, or certainly prioritising making money in their fossil fuel bits of their business as opposed to investment in those renewable sectors. It seems that they aren't actually holding up their end. As the pressure from governments has come off a little bit in the last couple of years, the investment hasn't kept pace.
Well, the reality that we're all facing as CEOs of energy companies is that we have the responsibility to provide the energy that the world needs. A very small statistic, Will. Every AI, ChatGPT search, consumes 10 times more energy than a Google search. So the revolution of AI and the automation and what we're talking about happening to the world over the next years will need a lot more energy to be produced from every source.
Absolutely. But I guess what I'm saying is that there's no way we're not keeping pace at the moment with what we got before adding those challenges on there. The industry, your industry, has not responded.
Well, we are. I'll give you a very concrete example. When all this started to become a major issue, we as a company, Energean, in 2019 committed, we were the first E&P company in the world to commit to a net zero strategy by 2050. We have reduced our carbon emissions by over 60% over the last years. And every CEO of every company is doing exactly the same. We are trying to decarbonize. We've set up, and this was a result, a tangible result of the last COP, the Oil and Gas Decarbonization Charter, which is a charter where 50 major global companies have committed to similar targets. So not only we're trying to decarbonize our industry, but we're working with solutions like carbon capture and storage, and the UK is the leader globally.
But give us a sense of the balance of your investments, you know, roughly percentages of what you're spending in upstream, as they call it, so drilling for new oil and gas, and what you're doing in those sectors, carbon capture.
Well, going forward, our investment is over $1 billion in the next project that we're developing in Israel. And in Israel, we are today...
But what's that in comparison to what you're doing in oil and gas?
And this is an oil and gas investment. And at the same time, we are developing a $1 billion investment for a carbon capture storage project in Greece. So our investment in carbon storage is increasing proportionally and even will be higher than the upstream investments. But the reality here is that our shareholders, the people that buy our shares every day, expect us to do two things. One, to produce results, tangible results, profits, dividends, growth, but at the same time, produce responsible results. And they expect us, and they're pushing us. All the funds, all the investors, all the banks are pushing us, and we do it ourselves, first of all, because, you know, the protection of the climate and the world is not just for climate activists. I want my children to live in a better world. And this applies to everybody around my organization. So we all are aligned behind the same targets. And this may sound like nice words, but the reality here is that we have a responsibility to bring energy to the world, energy to the UK, and killing the industry, increasing energy costs.
Yeah.
Looking back at the previous interview that you just had, will mean higher energy costs, will mean more job losses. And I think what the responsibility of every government is to bring these two together, not just kill one industry.
Be interesting to see how the week progresses. Matthew Thrigas speaking to us from Baku. They're the chief executive of the oil and gas company Energean. Let's turn to the financial markets now. Sweta Ramachandran, fund manager at Global Equities at Artemis Investment Management, is with us. Sweta, morning.
Morning, Will.
China, one of the big interesting areas this morning. We're going to talk about it a little bit later on after 7 o'clock as well. But this stimulus, or certainly attempts to inject more funds into local government, $1.4 trillion eventually, hasn't seen much of a positive market reaction this morning. Why?
I think it's precisely because there's been a lack of stimulus that we've seen a very muted reaction from the markets. The focus at this point from the Chinese government really seems to be about stabilizing rather than stimulating the economy. And so all of the measures are focused on backstopping the bad loans that local governments have made in respect of property, as well as backstopping the property market itself. And I think they're leaving themselves some dry powder from the potential impact of US tariffs before they really launch the next step, which would be actual consumer-driven demand-led stimulus.
With that there and what we're learning potentially about what the priorities for a Trump administration would be, there's a fair bit of headwinds, as the industry likes to say, for global equities, for global share markets at the moment.
Yeah, that's probably fair to say. I think particularly with respect to what the US might implement in terms of tariff policy, especially in the EU, there's been a certain amount of hand-wringing that's been going on, and that's likely to continue until the administration makes its actual plans clear.
One of those areas that has seen a big boom already, though, since the president's election has been Bitcoin, the value going through $80,000 a Bitcoin this morning.
So the new administration, the incoming administration, is seen as broadly more favourable in terms of their hands-off approach to regulating the sector, unlike the SEC, where Gary Gensler, the present chairman, has actually been quite vocal about his views that that crypto has led to several scams. And I think also if we think about potential inflation returning to the US as a result of tariffs as well as domestic policy, the appeal of crypto as a hedge against inflation again rises in this scenario.
Sweta, thanks so much for your time this morning. Sweta Ramachandran there, fund manager, global equities at Artemis Investment Management.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Always nice to see you in the flesh rather than this disembodied voice from Salford. Also here in the flesh at 29 minutes past six, it's Mike Williams with the sport.
Morning, Amal. We start today with a salute to this country's arguably greatest ever cyclist, who called it a day yesterday.
Cavendish in the centre. It's going to be Cavendish by the looks of things. Cavendish looks around. One more turn of the pedal and Sir Mark Cavendish takes it to crown an incredible career. He's done it again. The Manx missile delivers.
Sir Mark Cavendish, the most successful sprinter in cycling history, ended his career with victory in the Tour de France Criterium in Singapore.
What an incredible day to share my last race with those riders, to be able to race with them, my final race, to be able to beat them and win that race here in Singapore. I'm very, very happy. I'm very emotional, but very happy.
Cavendish won 165 races in his 19-year career, including the Road World title in 2011 and a record 35 stages in the Tour de France. Next to Barbados and another victory for England's cricketers over the West Indies yesterday. They were set a target of 159 to win the second T20, but ended up winning by 7 wickets. Kevin Howells was watching.
Well, it's hard to imagine there was debate at the halfway point whether 159 was tricky. And despite a golden duck for Phil Salt, first it was Will Jacks, then Captain Joss Butler, who made a nonsense of the chase being difficult. Both fell in the 13th over. 129 had been put on by the pair. Jacks, 38 off 29 balls. And fit again, Joss Butler, smashing 83 off 45 deliveries. Absolutely brutal. He was going for a 7th-6 when he was caught. Liam Livingstone saw them over the line with a 6. They go 2 up with 3 to go. St Lucia next on Thursday.
Football and busy day in the Premier League yesterday. More dropped points for Arsenal. A 1-1 draw at Chelsea leaves them 4th, 9 points behind the leaders Liverpool. Whilst at Old Trafford, Ruud van Nistelrooy signed off as Manchester United interim manager with his 3rd win in 4 matches, 3-0 over Leicester City.
It was a beautiful moment to come back to the club, doing these 4 games, all at home, getting some good results, some good goals, some good bits to build on. And my dad was here, my son, so special moments.
At the City Ground, Newcastle came from behind to beat Nottingham Forest 3-1. Whilst in North London, a near 25-year wait is over.
And there it is. Listen to the roars. Ipswich players fall to the ground. Exhaustion, but jubilation. They have got their first win of this Premier League season.
For the first time since April 2002, Ipswich Town have won a match in the Premier League. They beat Tottenham 2-1 yesterday. Elsewhere in Scotland, Celtic are just ahead of second-placed Aberdeen on goal difference at the top of the table after a 2-0 win at Kilmarnock. Victory 2 for Rangers, 1-0 over Hearts at home, but they remain 9 points off the pace. Whilst in the WSL, Chelsea moved back to second with a 3-0 win at Liverpool. And finally, Rugby Union, Scotland beaten yesterday 32-15 by the world champion South Africa, whilst Wales have equaled the country's record losing streak of 10 successive test defeats after a 24-19 loss to Fiji in Cardiff yesterday. And we will have more reflections on that and the woes of Welsh rugby at the moment later in the programme.
Full of sports records being broken. Thanks very much, Mike. More sport, as Mike said, later in the programme. It is now 28 minutes to 7. Let's hear about this week's Book at Bedtime.
Precipice by Robert Harris.
She slid across the leather banquette and kissed him on the cheek. My darling, I love you. I long to see you. The Prime Minister turned and smiled at her.
An illicit relationship becomes a matter of national security.
She had a sudden sense of danger and realised she was still holding the government file.
Intrigue and the onset of the First World War.
Early this morning, German troops invaded Luxembourg.
Precipice by Robert Harris. On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, this Monday to Friday night at 10:45.
Time now is 27 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds with Johnny Diamond and Amal Rajan. Here is a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
The US President-elect Donald Trump is reported to have spoken to Vladimir Putin after his election win last week. According to the Washington Post, he's urged Russia's president not to escalate the war in Ukraine. Mr. Trump's spokesman hasn't denied the report. Sakir Starmer is expected to discuss Ukraine and the Middle East during talks with President Macron in Paris this morning. The two leaders will then take part in Armistice Day commemorations, marking the anniversary of the end of the First World War. Leaders of Arab and Islamic states are gathering in Saudi Arabia for what's being called an emergency summit to discuss the conflicts in Gaza and Lebanon. Yesterday, Israel's new defence minister, Israel Katz, claimed Hezbollah had been defeated. The UN's climate talks, COP29, formally open in Azerbaijan. At the heart of the discussions will be deciding how much money richer countries should provide to help poorer ones transition away from fossil fuels. The conference takes place as the latest projections suggest this year will be the hottest on record. Pressure is building on the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, to stand down. Members of the General Synod have started a petition calling for him to resign. Last week, a report said Archbishop Welby was among those informed of the behaviour of one of the most prolific child abusers ever associated with the Church of England, but inadequate action led to further abuse. The details of a new law to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales are expected to be published early this week. The Labour MP Kim Leadbeater has said her bill will contain measures making the legislation the safest in the world for terminally ill people. Critics say they're worried people could be coerced into an assisted death. And the toy maker Mattel has said it deeply regrets mistakenly listing the address of a porn website on packaging for children's dolls. The company recently released singing figures inspired by the new film of the hit musical Wicked, but some fans spotted that a web address on the box was for an explicit site.
Thanks very much, Alan. There's a good 2 months before Donald Trump takes the oath of office, again, to become President of the United States. But the spotlight is already firmly on the incoming president and the team he'll build. The Washington Post reports this morning that Mr. Trump spoke by phone to Russian President Vladimir Putin last week and that Ukraine was discussed. The detail of Mr. Trump's policy towards Ukraine is not known, but he has said previously he would end the war between that country and Russia in 24 hours. Earlier I spoke to David Willis, our North America correspondent.
Well, there's been a lot of uncertainty, hasn't there, surrounding Donald Trump's intentions in regard to Ukraine. But discussions, it would appear, according to these reports anyway, are already underway, Johnny. The Washington Post reporting that Donald Trump spoke with Vladimir Putin on Thursday and discussed the war in Ukraine. And the president-elect reportedly advised Mr. Putin not to escalate the conflict and reminded him, according to the Post, of Washington's sizable military presence in Europe. Now, Mr. Trump's press spokesman hasn't confirmed or denied this report in the Washington Post. He said simply that we don't comment on private calls with other world leaders. But Donald Trump, of course, said on the campaign trail that he would end the war in Ukraine within a day. He didn't really specify how he intended to go about doing so, but he's made clear that he intends to use personal relationships in an attempt to obtain a ceasefire in Ukraine.
The suggestion, from the little detail there is that, contrary to what some people might have thought in the months running up to the election, there is no talk at the moment of the US leaving the arena, the US abandoning Ukraine. Instead, there is a negotiation being started.
Well, that's right. And indeed, Donald Trump spoke by phone with Vladimir Zelensky just a day before that conversation with Vladimir Putin. And of course, the White House is putting pressure on Mr. Trump. He's due to meet with Joe Biden on Wednesday to continue the commitment to Ukraine. But Donald Trump is known to be skeptical about continuing the supply of billions of dollars of US aid. And we know that he has a closer relationship with Vladimir Putin than he does with President Zelensky. He once called Mr. Zelensky the greatest salesman of any politician that ever lived. As to whether support will continue, well, Donald Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., shared a clip on Instagram which contains a picture of Mr. Zelensky saying, "You're 38 days from losing your allowance. Read into that what you will."
David Willis, thank you very much indeed.
22 minutes to seven. Should Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, resign? A growing number of the clergy say yes. It follows the sickening revelation of massive sexual abuse by John Smythe going back to the 1980s. He died in 2018, but not before abusing over 100 children while working for the Church of England. And a report published last week says there was a massive cover-up by the Church of England. Aleem McBull is our religion editor and joins us now. Aleem, how tenable, in your judgment, is the Archbishop's position?
It's looking increasingly difficult, frankly. There are now petitions that have been started. A major petition has been started by a group of members of the General Synod, the Church's National Assembly. And what's interesting to me is that while there's been a huge amount of infighting in the Church in recent years, it is people of different factions who are coming together in calling for Justin Welby to resign. No bishops have broken ranks as yet, those at the upper echelons of the Church. But without breaking any confidences, some have told me they do think the Archbishop of Canterbury should step down. The man himself said last week he had considered resigning over the issue, but he'd been persuaded by advisers to stay.
And his argument, of course, it's worth being really clear, Aleem, is that he says he had no awareness or suspicion of the allegations before he was told in 2013, and therefore he's reflected on it, but feels that given he had no awareness or suspicion, he's better off staying in post.
But the issue here is what happened after 2013.
Quite.
What he because he was told in 2013, this report that came out last week said that in black and white, but the abuse continued until 2018 when John Smythe died, having ended up, as you rightly say, abusing more than 120 people. And we also now know from that report that when when Archbishop Welby was interviewed about all of this about 5 years ago, he also didn't tell the truth about when he found out about John Smythe's abuses. He didn't acknowledge until this report came out that he knew the extent of John Smythe's abuses back in 2013. His supporters say he's done a lot of good, and what matters is that there is serious reform. But for those reasons, the fact that after 2013 others were abused,
just spell out there, Aleem, sorry,
he didn't tell the truth.
Just spell out when you say he didn't tell the truth. Just spell out what you mean exactly there.
So what happened ultimately was that this was all brought to light by journalists, by a Channel 4 documentary that came out in 2017. He was asked after that, he was interviewed about it, and he didn't let on, basically, that he had known years earlier. He was talking about what had been brought to light through the journalism, and at that stage did not say that he had known before. In fact, he said he didn't know the full extent of it before. We know now that he did, and it wouldn't have been just another case sort of in his inbox that he wouldn't have known about, what one would suspect, because he had known John Smythe for a very long time. So when something like this comes across his desk, it would have been something that stood out, because he'd known John Smythe for decades. He does say that he regrets that he didn't follow this with as much rigour as he should have done. But for a lot of people, including survivors of John Smythe's abuse, they say that is just not enough, and any reform is better happening under leadership with, well, in their words, more integrity.
Aleem McBull, our religion editor, thank you very much indeed. We'll return to this story at 7:30.
It's 18 minutes to seven right now. We expect the proposed legislation on assisted dying to be published this week, and the Prime Minister is on his way to Paris. Let's talk to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. Morning, Henry. We'll get the detail of the bill today. I mean, we already know the thrust of it, but is that detail important to how people judge the chances of its progress?
I think it's massively important, Johnny. By a sort of quirk of parliamentary procedure, primarily, we still haven't seen that detail. And MPs I speak to about this huge moral as well as political decision they are going to have to decide how to vote on in the coming weeks are desperate for that detail. There are a few things we already know. So we already know that under this bill being brought by Kim Leadbeater, a backbench Labour MP, assisted dying would be limited to those with less than 6 months to live. We know that it would require approval from a doctor, or actually doctors plural, as well as a judge. And Kim Leadbeater has been writing in The House magazine, that's a kind of trade magazine for politicians, today, where she said she believes her proposal will offer hope to those terminally ill people with a clear, informed and settled wish to have a better death, while at the same time protecting all those approaching the end of their life from coercion or pressure.
And Henry, we also see the Prime Minister on his way to Paris. These meetings with President Macron seem to come pretty thick and fast. What's the agenda for today?
Well, the agenda is, as it often is, between Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron, or indeed any Prime Minister and Emmanuel Macron. So the core bilateral issue is migration. There'll also be discussion about the international crises in the Middle East and Ukraine. But the new context for this discussion between the Prime Minister and the French President is, of course, the election of Donald Trump on Tuesday. You can expect, I think, the two leaders to talk in that context, especially about Ukraine, because they know that come January the 20th, there will be a US president who is at the very least significantly more sceptical of Western assistance and American assistance for Ukraine. And there are all sorts of questions that have been discussed at length before about what equipment, for example, Storm Shadow missiles, could be given to Ukraine. And while the view in the UK government remains that that's not some silver bullet, I think there will be discussions between the two leaders today about how to put Ukraine in the best possible position for winter, not just a tough winter of fighting, but a winter in which leadership in the US is going to change and change in a big way.
Henry, as always, thank you very much. Henry Zeffman there, our chief political correspondent.
It's 6:45. Let's turn to catfishing, the creation of fake online personas that lure those contacted into a world of blackmail and manipulation. One of the most prolific catfishers to have been discovered and convicted in the UK was Alexander McCartney from County Armagh in Northern Ireland. Earlier this month, he was given a life sentence for what he did. And I should say, some listeners may be upset or offended by what they're about to hear. McCartney was convicted for the extreme online sexual abuse of children and the manslaughter of a 12-year-old girl. Some of his victims have now spoken in a BBC documentary in the hope that more people will report these kinds of crimes. I should say we're protecting their identities, so we're not using their real names, but they've chosen to speak with their real voices.
I felt like it just wasn't going to end. I was crawled up against my door in my room, crying. At 12, I was very much like a nerd. It was hard making friends. I just remember feeling weirded out but kind of flattered at the same time. A girl's interested in me. I was just confused and scared.
Well, let's speak now to Chris Page, our Ireland correspondent. Chris, morning. For those that don't know the full context or background to what's going on here, just broadly speaking, tell us what McCartney did and what he's been convicted of.
Well, in courts, Amol, what really emerged was a picture of Alexander McCartney as a relentless and remorseless abuser. He pleaded guilty to almost 200 child sex offences, but police and prosecutors said that number of charges was brought
Chris, I think there's something going slightly awry with your line. Let's just try again. Can we get Chris Page back? Is he there? Let's see if we can get Chris Page back. The line, I don't think I was the only one who found the line go slightly awry, which is a shame because we're talking about such a serious subject. I tell you what, if we can get Chris back, we'll try and go back to that subject about catfishing. But for now, let's move on.
It is 6:50. There's already a small but vocal group of people who are suspicious of smart meters, the new gas and electricity meters that are connected to a wider computer network. They're able to send readings back to energy companies without a human in between. This evening's panorama on BBC One reveals a north-south divide in the way that smart meters work, that there are problems in parts of Northern England and Scotland in getting meters to connect properly. Zoe Conway is our employment correspondent and presents Panorama tonight. Zoe, how does the north-south divide work or not work? Why is connection much more difficult and what is the scale of the problem?
What happened was when smart meters were rolled out across Britain 12 years ago, a technological divide was created. In the south of England, the Midlands and in Wales, smart meters rely on the equivalent of mobile phone technology to send signals about what energy you're using back to your energy supplier. But in the north of England and Scotland, they rely on radio frequencies. And this was for good reason, because the population tends to be more spread out and there are mountains and hills to be contended with. So that's why they decided to use radio frequencies. But what we've heard from speaking to engineers is a frustration that there's a fix available down in the south of England and that central region, which is, if it goes wrong, the signal, you can boost it using an aerial. But that fix is not available if you're in the north of England or in Scotland. And we spoke to one customer called Hartesh, who lives in Glasgow. He's been on 6 metres with none of them working, and the problem was the signal. And we spoke to his energy supplier. He's had 2, but the latest one is Octopus Energy. And they've actually, having spoken to BBC Panorama, they decided to fix his problem, but by breaking the rules, because they're not supposed to connect him to the mobile network, but they've done it to try and help him. And they voiced their frustration that they're having to break the rules to do this, and the rules are too rigid.
And how many households do you think? Sorry, thanks, yeah.
Sorry, yes. We know that there are 36 million smart meters in Britain, and we know that, according to government figures, 3.5 million aren't working properly, and a lot of the time is to do with signal problems. And what Energy UK, that represents the energy suppliers, has admitted to us is that there are issues in the north. Now, just to be clear, the suppliers are not responsible for the communication network. That is run by a company called Capita, and they've told us in a statement that they provide 99.3% coverage across Great Britain, and they're actively working with the government to provide 4G technology for the whole of Britain.
Zoe, thank you very much indeed. Zoe Conway, who is presenting tonight's Panorama, which you can see on BBC One at 8 o'clock.
It's 10 to 7. Let's go back to Chris Page, our island correspondent. Slightly dodgy line, for which, sorry, Chris, probably lost in the ether somewhere, but we've got you back. And just tell us, Chris, with this documentary about catfishing, some of the victims speaking out, what's the key discovery that this documentary has made?
Yes, the documentary is focusing on the prosecution of Alexander McCartney from County Armagh in Northern Ireland. He pleaded guilty to almost 200 child sex offences, but police and prosecutors said that number of charges was brought in order to move the case forward. In reality, police estimate there were about 3,500 victims around the world, and most were girls aged between 10 and 14. McCartney was jailed for life last year. He's got to serve at least 20 years in prison before he can be considered for early release. And in the documentary, which is called Teen Predator Online Killer, it's on BBC iPlayer now, victims describe what happened to them. Now, this is known as catfishing. McCartney pretended to be a teenage girl online, then he tricked his victims into sending them explicit pictures of themselves. Then he turned on them, told them he would post the pictures publicly unless they carried out acts of abuse, and sent him the images. And one victim took her own life. 12-year-old Simran Thomas from West Virginia died in 2018, and McCartney was convicted of manslaughter in relation to her death. So the three-part documentary hears from police in the US, in New Zealand, who helped in the investigation to bring McCartney to justice. Also detectives here in Northern Ireland, of course. So we hear, for example, that on one of McCartney's 64 devices, police discovered 232,000 illegal images, and detectives really paint a picture of the shock that they felt when they discovered the scale of his offending. But the most moving voices are from the victims, who really have spoken out in the hope that they'll help other people and encourage them to report similar crimes.
Chris Page, our island correspondent, good to get you back. Thank you.
It is 6:58.
Let's turn to the Middle East, because Qatar announced this weekend that it will pause its role as a mediator in the ceasefire talks between Hamas and Israel due to the lack of willingness on both sides to reach an agreement. Let's speak to Oliver McTernan, director of Forward Thinking, which is a conflict resolution group. He's got an established background in interfaith relationships. And Oliver, I think you spent nearly 2 decades working in the Middle East trying to bring people together. Why has Qatar pulled out, do you think?
Well, for what to say, that the lack of commitment, they would say, on both sides to reach a conclusion, to bring this brutal war, in their words, to an end, hostages returned and prisoners released. I'm surprised, actually, it's taken them so long to come to this decision, because right from the beginning, I felt that the two goals Netanyahu set, the elimination of Hamas and the return of the hostages were incompatible. I didn't see how you could negotiate if the end goal, the other end goal, was actually to see the total demise of the people you were negotiating with. So it came no surprise to me that they've come to this conclusion. What surprises me is it's taken them so long.
How did Qatar come to have this role?
Because they have played a very independent role in the Gulf, the Middle East, over a number of years. And they decided when Hamas was proscribed and, no one was, they felt that the best way of keeping stability, of avoiding the sort of conflict that sadly has arisen now, was actually to give support, not political endorsement, but, as we say, engagement is not necessarily endorsement. And I think Qatar has been very careful over the years playing that role, that it's tried to give for Palestinians the support, the Gazan people support they needed, without, in fact, endorsing Hamas.
And given the scale of what happened on October the 7th last year and since, how do you even begin to approach a negotiation between two sides who seem so far apart?
Well, if you set a goal, and I think if there was one goal set, and that was the release of the hostages in exchange for some of the long-term Palestinian prisoners, I think that was achievable. And I think you could have avoided this brutal and unbelievable situation now we find in Gaza. And sadly, I think when you have a split vision, you are not going to achieve either.
Do you think, as it were, that Netanyahu, he's in a very strong political position at home in some ways, because, he stayed there, he had that falling out with his former defence minister, Yoav Gallant, who left his role earlier this week. Do you think, in a sense, that Netanyahu stacked this negotiation by, as you say, presenting two ultimately irreconcilable objectives, which in a way gave him the power to prolong this conflict?
I think that's a very interesting question, because if you look at the wording of the Qatar statement, it says using negotiations to continue the war for narrow political purposes. Now, Gallant was forced out of Netanyahu's government simply because he said the war aims are finished. Why are we continuing it? I think many would say that Netanyahu's purpose in finishing the war is that he continues as prime minister. Once the war has ended, the reckoning begins, and we forget that he began this war appearing in court in the courthouse in East Jerusalem every morning, and that case had to be suspended. So I think there's something in what the Qataris have said.
So much for Netanyahu. What of the Palestinians? How split or how coherent is Palestinian leadership?
It is the big problem. And I think it's not just the different factions in Palestine, but I think within the movements too, there's always been the tension between achieving the goal independent Palestinian state and achieving it either by negotiation, political process, or military process. And I think that has not been resolved. And until it is, I fear, that we will still find ourselves in this impasse.
Quick final thought. If they called you up, as many people have done in recent years, and said, Oliver, what do we need to do now, today, to get towards peace? What would you say?
A ceasefire. I think one person can leave something of his legacy that I fear is in tatters at the moment in the Middle East, is Joe Biden. And to make clear he's stopping the arms supply and insisting. Not the minute he said there are no red lines, I think was saying the international order is not applicable in this situation. And that's why we are where we are.
Oliver McTernan, Director of Forward Thinking. Very good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Take a moment with BBC Radio 3 Unwind, the new destination for music to unwind your mind. Set yourself up for the morning with Dr. Sian Williams' selection of soothing classical tracks. And join Oliver Arnold's as you wind down in the evening with ultimate calm.
Music that can bring complete peace of mind.
Radio 3 Unwind. Listen on BBC Sounds.
We're creeping towards 7 o'clock. Now the weather forecast. Sarah Keith Lucas is here with news of something called sunshine.
Yes, absolutely. Some of that on the way, Johnny, over the next few days. And we have been waiting long enough to see it, haven't we? It's been really cloudy and dull over the past 2 weeks, but we've got a clearer and colder air mass moving in. Still high pressure dominating our weather, so lots of dry weather through today and the week ahead. But yes, more of that blue sky on offer. Now this morning, we've still got quite a lot of high cloud around, so any sunshine is a little bit hazy, but the cloud will tend to thin and break through the day. And there's a little bit of drizzly rain still sitting across parts of southwest England. That is the weakening weather front, which is clearing away towards the south. So then we're all in that brighter air mass through the course of today. A little bit more cloud toppling in for parts of Northern Ireland and for Scotland as well. Any early morning mist and fog clearing away. Just one or two showers today across the north of Scotland. They're generally going to be easing, but you could catch one around the east coast of England, perhaps North York Moors, down towards East Anglia, for instance, as well. Most of us, though, looking dry and bright, with top temperatures a touch cooler than recent days, 10 to 12 for most, perhaps 14 down towards the southwest, but the sunshine to compensate. And then overnight tonight, it's looking clear and dry for most of us again. Some mist and fog tonight, and that'll be particularly through central areas, so the Midlands, Wales, Northern England, Northern Ireland and Southern Scotland seeing some mist and fog overnight. Temperatures down to about 2 to 5 degrees, so a fairly chilly night ahead. Tomorrow, though, mist and fog clears away. More sunshine for most of us, but a few showers in the southeast.
Sarah, thank you so much. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Amol Rajan.
It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 11th of November. The headlines. Donald Trump is reported to have cautioned Vladimir Putin against any escalation of the war in Ukraine in a phone call soon after winning the US presidential election. Members of the Church of England's governing body have begun a petition calling for the Archbishop of Canterbury to stand down over his handling of an abuse scandal. We'll be speaking to one of his critics at 7:30. And the MP behind the draft law to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales says it contains the strictest safeguards anywhere in the world.
Also coming up before 8 o'clock, we talk a lot on this programme about artificial intelligence. But what if the robots we build don't like the jobs we give them?
I've been ordered to take you up to the bridge. Here I am, brain the size of a planet, and they tell me to take you up to the bridge. Call that job satisfaction, because I don't.
We'll talk to the academics addressing concerns that robots could go the way of Marvin the Paranoid Android from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
A clearer picture may be emerging of Donald Trump's approach to the war in Ukraine, with him reportedly issuing a direct warning to President Putin not to escalate the conflict. According to the Washington Post, the president-elect reminded the Russian leader of the sizable American military presence in Europe. Mr. Trump's election victory has raised concerns about the future of the war. He's promised to swiftly resolve it, but not provided any further plans. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports.
There's been uncertainty about Donald Trump's approach to the war in Ukraine, but it now appears discussions started only hours after his election victory. According to the Washington Post, the president-elect spoke to Vladimir Putin on Thursday and urged a speedy resolution to the conflict. Mr. Trump's spokesman hasn't denied the reports, which follow a campaign pledge to end the nearly three-year-long war within a day. Mr. Trump is known to be sceptical about the continued supply of billions of dollars of U.S. aid for Ukraine, but the White House is urging the incoming administration not to turn its back on the country in the face of growing Russian aggression. Joe Biden's national security adviser, Jake Sullivan, said the president would use his remaining time in office to make the case that Ukraine should continue to be granted military support.
The war in Ukraine and any shift in American policy are expected to be high on the agenda when Keir Starmer holds talks with President Macron in Paris. The pair will meet before attending Armistice Day commemorations near the Champs-Élysées to mark the anniversary of the end of the First World War. Keir is believed to be the first British Prime Minister to attend the ceremony since Winston Churchill joined Charles de Gaulle in 1944. From Paris, here's Hugh Schofield.
It's an important year for British-French relations, with the 120th anniversary of the alliance known as the Entente Cordiale, the 80th anniversary of the Normandy landings, plus since July, a new government in London promising a reset of cross-channel relations following the trauma of Brexit. The Prime Minister will start his day with a breakfast meeting with his French opposite number, Michel Barnier, a reminder that since the elections in France in the summer, it's not just with President Macron that he has to deal. With the President then at the Élysée Palace, discussions will inevitably centre on European security, Ukraine and the Middle East, and the likely impact of the incoming Trump administration. And after that, there'll be the ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier beneath the Arc de Triomphe, a chance to reflect on the shared sacrifices of the past and their message for today.
Donald Trump's return to the White House will also buoy on the minds of leaders of Arab and Islamic states at an emergency summit in Saudi Arabia. They're gathering to discuss the fighting in Gaza and Lebanon. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner is in the Saudi capital, Riyadh.
Exactly 1 year has passed since the last emergency Arab-Islamic summit was held here. Since then, despite urgent calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, there's been no let-up in the conflict, and Israel has taken its fight beyond Hamas to Hezbollah, the Houthis, and Iran. Delegates arriving here from a number of Arab and Islamic nations want to see an immediate halt to the fighting. But overshadowing this conference are two things: Iran's next move and the election of Donald Trump for a second term. He's popular with the Saudis, but he's also a firm supporter of Israel and hawkish when it comes to Iran. The Islamic Republic has vowed to hit back at Israel for its missile attack of 2 weeks ago, the latest in a tit-for-tat exchange.
The UN climate talks, COP29, are formally opening this morning in Azerbaijan's capital, Baku. The focus this year will be on how much money richer countries will provide to help poorer ones transition away from fossil fuels. The Archbishop of Canterbury is facing more calls from within the Church of England to step down after it was revealed what he knew about the behaviour of one of its most prolific child abusers. John Smythe is believed to have abused more than 100 boys and young men. A damning report published last week concluded that an inadequate response by the church allowed him to continue. Members of the General Synod have now started a petition calling on Justin Welby to resign. Our religion editor, Ali McBull, reports.
The Archbishop of Canterbury's acknowledged he should have more rigorously followed up details he'd been given of the abuse in 2013. Instead, John Smythe continued to abuse boys and young men until his death in 2018. We now also know that when asked about it, the Archbishop previously did not tell the truth about how much he knew and for how long. Justin Welby says he did consider resigning over the issue last week, but was persuaded not to. The petition of members of the Church's National Assembly says there's no alternative to him stepping down. Certainly there are others in the Church of England who engaged in an overt cover-up of John Smythe's abuse as far back as the early 1980s and who have serious questions to answer. But in an often deeply divided church, support for Archbishop Welby stepping down for his personal culpability is starting to come from both its conservative and progressive wings.
Victims of one of the world's most prolific online child abusers say they hope the case will encourage more people to report internet sex crimes. Alexander McCartney, who's 26 and from County Armagh, was sentenced to life in prison last month. Some of those he targeted have spoken for the first time in a BBC series, as our Ireland correspondent Chris Page reports.
Police estimate that Alexander McCartney targeted 3,500 children over 5 years. He pretended to be a teenage girl online and tricked his victims into sending him explicit photos of themselves. McCartney then threatened to post the pictures publicly unless they carried out acts of abuse. 12-year-old Simran Thomas from the US took her own life after McCartney blackmailed her. In the documentary series Teen Predator, Online Killer, victims speak about their ordeals in the hope it'll help others. One of them, whose identity we're protecting, said she was glad she reported the abuse to police.
People have lost their lives over this. I reported him and he got caught. Speak out, because you truly never know the magnitude of the situation you're dealing with.
McCartney's victims came from around 30 countries in Europe, Australia, New Zealand and North and South America. Detectives from the Police Service of Northern Ireland say they discovered 232,000 indecent images of children on one of his 64 devices.
The full series, Teen Predator Online Killer, is available on BBC iPlayer now. The details of a new law to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales are expected to be published early this week. The Labour MP behind the draft legislation has said it will be the strictest of its kind in the world. Opponents say the safest law is the one currently in place. Here's our political correspondent Harry Farley.
The proposed legislation is expected to run to more than 40 pages and is being published after lengthy consultation with experts. Kim Leadbeater, the Labour MP for Spen Valley, who's bringing the private members' bill, says it will, in her words, contain the strictest protections and safeguards of any legislation anywhere in the world. Of the dozens of MPs I've spoken to, many support the change, but many others have concerns about the impact on disabled people and whether it could open the door to future changes. There are also lots of MPs yet to make up their mind, with some holding open meetings to ask constituents for their views.
That was our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
Thanks very much, Alan. It is 9 minutes past seven. It's not yet a week since Donald Trump swept the US elections, and already his phone calls alone are causing tremors around the world. The Washington Post is reporting that within a couple of days of the result, Mr. Trump was on the phone to Vladimir Putin, and according to the Post, the president-elect warned Mr. Putin not to escalate the war in Ukraine. All of this against the background of Mr. Trump's hostility towards Americans paying for Ukraine's defence and his stated belief that he can end the war within 24 hours. The concern in Kyiv and across Europe being that Mr. Trump is about to force Ukraine to do the kind of land for peace deal it has resisted for so long and at such cost. From Camp Trump regarding the phone call to Mr. Putin, no comment. Let's speak to our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg. Steve, I don't suppose you got a readout from the Kremlin, did you?
No readout, Johnny. I mean, the truth is, we don't know what the truth is, right? We don't know if there was a call, what was discussed. The Trump transition team hasn't confirmed it. So far, no comment from the Kremlin. No official readout of the conversation, a conversation that wasn't conducted via the State Department like Donald Trump's other calls post-election. All of this, you know, may cause some concern in Kyiv, although we should point out that Donald Trump and President Zelensky had their own conversation, a telephone conversation, last Wednesday.
If you were coming to this fresh, you might think that a phone call from the president-elect to Mr. Putin saying, do not escalate your war in Ukraine, was actually good news for Ukraine, that Ukraine is not being abandoned by the incoming administration, but instead there is some kind of strengthening of the line. Is that how you read it?
I think we don't know enough about this telephone conversation to reach that conclusion. Mm. I think if you look at the signs, at the bigger picture, then there's a lot of concern for Kyiv. I mean, if you look at what Donald Trump was saying, or rather what he wasn't saying, on the campaign trail, yeah, he was conspicuous by his lack of criticism of Vladimir Putin, right? He seemed to blame Joe Biden more for Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine than blame Putin himself, you know, claiming that if he, Donald Trump, had been in the White House in 2022, Putin would never have taken the decision to invade. And we know that he's been critical, Donald Trump, of the tens of billions of dollars worth of US military and economic aid that America has sent to Ukraine. You know, a total contrast with Kamala Harris, who said publicly that supporting Ukraine was in America's strategic interest. And we also know what J.D. Vance, vice president-elect, said in September. He sort of sketched out the outline of a possible peace plan for Ukraine, which actually sounded like Vladimir Putin's peace plan, that Russia could keep the territory it had seized, Ukraine would pledge neutrality, so no Ukraine joining NATO, and there would be a demilitarized zone. So taking all of that together, those are worrying signs, I think, for Ukraine as we move into this new period with, you know, possible talk of deals, peace deals in the future.
I mean, you'll have also seen or seen reference to this social media post from Donald Trump Jr. with a picture of the Ukrainian president and the caption, 38 days until your allowance is ended. The allowance, presumably a reference to those tens of billions of dollars flowing towards Ukraine's defence. A sign there, a suggestion there, that America's mind is made up?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's another example of why Ukraine should probably be worried. I mean, that video that Donald Trump Jr. shared indicating that, yeah, America could turn off the taps regarding military assistance to Ukraine. So this will be a major concern. On the other hand, you have Vladimir Putin, who is coming across increasingly confident. We were in Sochi last week when Putin took part in this big discussion group. And he was on television live more than 4 hours, and you could tell he was brimming with confidence. This is a man who survived sanctions, nearly 3 years of Western sanctions. Things are going better for him on the battlefield in eastern Ukraine. Now there is a US president who's been elected who doesn't criticize him, doesn't talk about inflicting a strategic defeat on Russia, but instead talks about peace. So I think the Russians are very confident now that they can end this war on conditions beneficial to Russia.
Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, thank you very much.
14 minutes past seven, businesses big and small are calling on the Chancellor to reverse the rise in employer national insurance. What started out as a backlash is turning into a revolt. If you recall, the rate is increasing from 13.8% to 15%, and the threshold at which it is charged is being reduced from £9,100 per employee to £5,000. Tesco said it's going to pay a further £1 billion in the tax this Parliament. Last week, the bosses of Sainsbury's, Asda and Morrison revealed they were liable for an extra £1.3 billion between them. More than 200 hospitality bosses have also written to the Chancellor, as we're hearing from Will Bain in his business update at 6:15 this morning, to detail their grave fears. And other small businesses are hurting too. Tracy Harvey is Managing Director of Harvey's of Halifax, a department store in Halifax. And Luke Johnson is an entrepreneur and director, among other businesses, of the Gales Bakery chain. Good morning to you both. Tracy, good morning. Tracy, if I could start with you, what impact will this have on your business?
It's been pretty devastating, actually. We haven't fully calculated the financial impact. It's the most serious thing that we will have had to face as our business, absolutely. You know, we traded through COVID and came out very well, very strong. And this is, it's a really devastating blow for us.
Give us a sense of numbers. So, how will this affect your labour costs? Can you give us some examples of how prices might change?
Sure. Yeah. We. I mean, in the retail and hospitality industry, where a number of our teams are on the National Living Wage, you know, we've had to deal with a 40% increase since 2021. So the living wage has increased by 40%. Every year, the last 3 years, it's cost me about £100,000 extra in wages. So it's, you know, it's not that my business is failing as such. Our sales are growing. We're doing very well, but my sales are not growing, you know, at anywhere near the same rate as these increasing costs year on year.
So you were founded in 1926, Tracy. Will you make it to 2026?
I'm really hoping we do. I can't be as confident now as I was last week.
Okay. Let me put that to Luke Johnson. Luke, before I put some of the counter arguments to you, just tell me, what do you think of this change and what impact will it have on business?
Well, I think it's a mistake because it's a tax on jobs, it's a tax on work, it's a regressive tax because it will hit low earners. And for labour-intensive businesses like hospitality or retailing, it's enormously discouraging. And how our government, who say, you know, their priority is growth and wealth creation, can then introduce a problem tax like this. You know, as Tracy was saying, for entrepreneurs and investors, it's, you know, it's a bad blow.
What impact will this have on Gales?
It's millions of pounds. And we have some terrible choices to make about whether we cut back on growth or we employ fewer people or we change shifts or other impacts. I mean, Gales is pretty successful, but I'm involved with other businesses that are still recovering from the devastation of lockdowns and of energy inflation. And they are going to face some really tough choices.
Let me put as you'd expect, Luke, the counter argument to you. The government would say, if you need to find billions for the public finances, why not say to companies like Gales, like others that you run, which are profitable and successful and growing, that for a short time your profits are going to be slightly lower in order to help fill this public black hole?
Well, what I would say is, can we not also talk about reform of the public sector, where, as we know, productivity has been flat? And how can they talk about wanting growth and wealth creation if their taxes are going to mean that businesses might close, entrepreneurs might give up, and or people might not invest? And £25 billion, which is what this will raise, is, I think I'm right in saying, the largest single tax measure ever introduced. It's not small.
And the other argument, Luke, before I just go back to Tracy for a final word, is that if you use that £25 billion to get the NHS out of a hole, to reduce the long-term sick in this country, which is a very big problem, we're approaching £100 billion a year we're about to spend on welfare and sickness, that should, in the long term, help everybody, and businesses, therefore, should make a contribution.
Businesses are already enormously highly taxed. The truth is, I don't think they should be taxing work or jobs. I think they should be taxing, for example, high-end residential property rather more, which is much lower tax than in many other countries.
It's an interesting idea, which we shall put to them at one point. Tracy, if I could go back to you for a moment. The hospitality industry has floated the idea of a lower rate of 5% for those in the band between 5,000 and 9,100, or an exemption for lower band taxpayers working fewer than 20 hours a week. Which of those would be your preference?
Just gives us a little bit of leeway. You know, we've also got the increase in business rates to deal with. That was the triple whammy that we got within the budget. So anything that will just help, you know, reconsider what, you know, what this is going to mean for a lot of businesses in our industry.
All right, Tracy Harvey, Managing Director of Harveys of Halifax, and Luke Johnson, entrepreneur and director and investor. Thank you both very much indeed.
It is 7:20. As businesses grapple with their tax rise, China is grappling with how to kickstart an economy that's wading through treacle. And there's been a pretty mixed reaction from the markets this morning to its latest attempt. Will is back with more on that.
Yeah, wading through treacle feels like a good phrase, actually, because it's gone on for some time too, hasn't it? And the latest attempt, $1.4 trillion stimulus attempt, as you say, Johnny, hasn't exactly wowed financial markets this morning. Han Lin is Associate Professor at NYU Shanghai. He's also a former senior executive at the bank Wells Fargo's Chinese arm. Han, morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to join.
To massively oversimplify what was a complicated package, this was basically aimed at propping up the debt of local government, right? This stimulus that we got Friday into Saturday, and what investors were hoping for was more to deal with the consumption issues in the Chinese economy, get people spending again, right?
Absolutely. I think China's facing a dilemma right now. Really, in the last 2 years or so, China had been trying to export its way to GDP growth. And certainly now with the recent U.S. elections, there's some clear signaling that that strategy is probably not going to work going forward, as various nations, not only the U.S., but Europe, might start raising tariffs, which means there has to be more of a focus on domestic consumption growth. But the markets are always looking at a different timeline. They want results faster. Hence, you are right that the market was a bit disappointed, both at the top line and the fact that there wasn't clear differentiation of how specific issues like consumption growth would be targeted.
Well, you raised it, the potential of a 60% tariff, President-elect Trump has said, on anything imported into America from China. Is this something that Chinese authorities now shrug off? Are they kind of used to this, or is this actually at a level that poses a different, a new kind of threat?
I think it's a very serious threat from China's growth model standpoint. I think there were two events actually that happened in China that were overshadowed by the U.S. election. Not only this stimulus announcement by the National People's Congress, but the fact that China recently held the China International Import Expo. And this is pretty important because China doesn't want to lose that connection of trade. And so maybe part of the message is in order for the rest of the world to welcome more U.S. goods, China will likewise welcome more foreign goods into the country. And so you have a bit of that charm offensive that is starting to play out now and probably even more so going forward.
And as this ramps up between the US and China again, do you see, I mean, we're seeing it in some company shares already, aren't we? Do you see countries and companies outside the US and China also being drawn into all of this?
Absolutely. I think one of the key questions is, well, in all the challenges of the tariffs going up by the U.S. side, what are the relative value propositions China might have to try to divide sentiment against China to make some countries more pro-China, at least on the trade side? And I think there's going to be a lot of messaging back and forth because I do believe the Chinese government takes seriously the announcements that China could very well raise tariffs and at a very significant level.
Something to keep watching. Han Lin, Associate Professor of Finance at NYU Shanghai. Thanks so much for your time.
Will, thank you very much indeed. 23 minutes past seven is the time. The explosion of content online with those sequential revolutions of the internet, smartphones and social media has led also to an explosion of a new form of employment, online content moderation. And in this domain, at least, there is a limit to what machines can do. Real, actual humans are required, and they're often looking at very grim stuff, as a new Radio 4 series by our technology editor Zoe Kleinman explores from today. She spoke to Mojez, or Mohez, I think it is, a former TikTok moderator in Kenya who features in the series. He says his job required him to watch hundreds of horrific and traumatizing videos.
You'll do one video, it's suicide. The other video, beheading. The other one, rape. Like, it's a constant stream of distressing content. Content from all over the globe. It started getting worse for me personally. I used to suffer from insomnia. I used to sleep for like 3 hours only. Yeah, it's a very isolating job.
Well, Zoe joins us now. Zoe, morning. What a grim world you've been investigating.
Morning. It has been a very powerful experience. I think there were some times when we spoke to moderators, my producer Tom and I would just sit in silence afterwards because we just had nothing to say. You know, these people have such harrowing stories to tell, and the cost that it's taken on their mental health has been really considerable. I mean, one said, you know, he found it difficult to interact with his children because he'd seen so much child abuse, which is just an incredibly difficult conversation to have. But I have to say that despite all of this, you know, Amal, I was expecting them to say, this work is so grim, it's so difficult, we don't think anyone should do it. You know, where is AI? Come on, we want this to be fully automated. And some of them were quite angry about it, but a lot of them were incredibly proud of what they were doing. They said they felt like an emergency service for the internet. One said, you know, he felt like a paramedic or a firefighter, and he wanted a uniform, he wanted a badge. So actually, they're not necessarily saying they don't want to do the work, but they're saying they want to be treated better and they want to be acknowledged more, I think, for this grim task. But frankly, we talk so much, don't we, about online safety, and these people, these thousands of people working around the world, often for outsourced companies, not directly for the big tech companies themselves, they are at the very front line of that online safety that we have.
And what do the tech companies themselves say about it? Because, of course, they've invested a lot of money. I mean, they're very rich, a lot of them, the big ones, but they've invested a lot of money and they've expanded this kind of workforce dramatically in recent years. So what do they say about the kind of work that's going on and how necessary it is?
TikTok said it knows content moderation isn't easy and it said it strives to promote a caring working environment for staff, including programs to support their well-being and clinical support as well. It said all videos are auto-reviewed beforehand and it believes that removes a large chunk of them. I also spoke to Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, and they told me every company they work with has to offer 24-hour on-site support with trained professionals, and also said that moderators have a tool that they can use to blur graphic content. And I also spoke to OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, because some of the moderators I spoke to were labelling data to train that AI model, and that included having to label harmful data so that ChatGPT didn't regurgitate it. OpenAI said it was grateful for the work of these trainers and that it enforces policies to protect their well-being.
Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. Zoe, thank you very much indeed. You can hear the moderators with our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, on Radio 4 today at 1:45. Also available, of course, on BBC Sounds.
It is 27 minutes past seven, and that means it's time for more sport with Mike.
Johnny, thank you. Is the Premier League title race already a two-horse race? More dropped points for Arsenal yesterday sees them fourth this morning, 9 points behind leaders Liverpool. Well, football correspondent John Murray watched Arsenal's 1-1 draw at Chelsea yesterday and joins us live in the studio now. Morning, John.
Morning, Mike.
Nothing done and dusted in November, of course, but it's already looking a long road back for Arsenal, isn't it?
Yeah, they could have won it with the last kick of the match at Stamford Bridge last night, but they didn't. So it is now four Premier League matches without a win for Arsenal, who, don't forget, were one of the pre-season favourites to actually win the title this season. But that draw leaves them, and Chelsea for that matter, on the fringes of the title race and a hefty 9 points behind top of the table Liverpool.
As for Manchester City in second, you also watched them lose at Brighton on Saturday, a fourth consecutive defeat for City in all competitions, and that hasn't happened for 18 years.
Shock of shocks. Lose four in a row. Pep Guardiola lost their last two in the Premier League. They are still second in the table, but for them to find themselves in a slump like this has got everyone scratching their heads, not least Pep Guardiola himself, who is talking about using this international window now to regroup. And they will need to do that because their next league matches are against Tottenham and then at Anfield against Liverpool.
Difficult run coming up. Things much better for City's rivals Manchester United there. They beat Leicester 3-0 in Ruud van Nistelrooy's last match as interim head coach yesterday, and we're expecting the new manager Ruben Amorim to arrive today, I think.
Yeah, new man on his way. He had his last match with Sporting last night, a dramatic win from 2-0 down against another of his former clubs, Braga, which means he leaves them having won 11 out of 11 in the Portuguese league this season. You can't do much better than that. But yeah, to Manchester now to begin the big job once he gets his work visa sorted out. So we'll be talking a lot about Ruben Amorim over the coming weeks.
But come on, John, forget Arsenal, City, United. I can hear the whole of Suffolk screaming at their radios this morning. Mention Ipswich Town winning a game in the Premier League for the first time since 2002.
Yeah, great day for them. They've had some notable results, but they've been draws in the Premier League. So to get that first win, even though we're well into November, but the one win moves them up and out of the relegation zone. And the target for Ipswich is stay up, and they've given themselves a fighting chance.
Yeah, great win for them yesterday. So that is it for the Premier League for a fortnight now. As you say, John, the final international break of the year is upon us. Players heading off to play for their country, but actually, some of them might rather be staying at home.
Yeah, this will be the talking point over the course of the next day or so. The club managers, I know Mikel Arteta, Pep Guardiola, petrified that their players are going to get injured on international duty. So Declan Rice and Bukayo Saka, whether they're going to join up with England, I'm not sure. Martin Odegaard for Norway and Manchester City as well. Whether Jack Grealish, who's missed the last six matches, whether he'll go with England or not. And there are plenty of others as well.
Interesting times. I know you're off to Greece later this week for England's match there on Thursday. John Murray, many thanks for joining us. Just to say, we'll be talking rugby union in the next hour. What is happening at Wales? They slumped to a 10th successive test defeat yesterday. We'll try and answer that question a little later on in the programme. And finally, I'll leave you with this, Amal. Anyone who follows you on social media will know that you are a recent convert to running. Have you done a park run yet?
Don't shame me. No, I haven't. No.
Okay, well,
I managed to run for about 20 minutes, but not in a park.
Okay, well, here's something for you to aim at. Yesterday, you may have seen this. 19-year-old from Northern Ireland set a new world's best time for a park run. Nick Griggs from County Tyrone completed the 5 kilometres course in Belfast in 13 minutes and 44 seconds. That is fast.
Well, give me a couple of weeks and I'll smash his record.
Yeah, we'll get back to you on that one. 13 minutes and 44 seconds. Good luck, Amol. It is 29 minutes to 8. Quick look at the weather. Today we'll see any early cloud in the far south soon diminish to leave a largely dry and bright day. Bright skies elsewhere too. Scotland will see some areas of cloud. By the evening, it will be mainly clear and dry. For most, some clouds will move into the far north later, and some patchy cloud is possible in eastern England later. Also, there'll be a cold night with light winds.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds with Johnny Diamond and Amol Rajan. It is now 28 minutes to 8, and here is a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Donald Trump's campaign team hasn't denied a report that he spoke to Vladimir Putin 2 days after winning the US election. According to the Washington Post, Mr. Trump warned the Russian leader against escalation in Ukraine and reminded him of America's substantial military presence in Europe. President Biden's national security adviser has urged Mr. Trump not to abandon Ukraine.
Sir Keir Starmer has been greeted by President Macron in Paris, where the two leaders are expected to discuss Ukraine and the Middle East. They'll then take part in Armistice Day commemorations marking the anniversary of the end of the First World War. Leaders of Arab and Muslim states are gathering for an emergency summit in Saudi Arabia, where they'll discuss the conflicts in Gaza and Lebanon. Delegates want to see an immediate end to Israel's military action against Hamas and Hezbollah. Yesterday, Israel's new defence minister, Israel Katz, claimed Hezbollah had been defeated. Pressure is building on the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, as members of the General Synod have started a petition calling for him to resign. Last week, a report said he was among those informed of the behaviour of John Smythe, one of the most prolific abusers ever associated with the Church of England, but inadequate action failed to stop him. The latest COP International Climate Conference is getting underway in Baku in Azerbaijan. At the heart of the discussions will be deciding how much money richer countries should provide to help poorer ones transition away from fossil fuels. And victims of one of the world's most prolific online child abusers say they hope the case will encourage more people to report internet sex crimes. Alexander McCartney, who's 26 and from County Armagh, was sentenced to life in prison last month. Police estimate he targeted more than 3,500 children over 5 years.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. As Alan mentions there, John Smythe, since the 1980s, may have abused over, well, did abuse over 100 children and young men, usually in a soundproof shed at the end of his garden. It may have been the most prolific abuse scandal in the modern history of the Church of England. What's more, senior leaders of the Church of England knew. They weren't just negligent in dealing with the allegations, which have been rumoured for decades, but actively covered it up, according to a report published last week by Keith Makin. One person who knew Smythe but says he didn't know about the abuse is the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. Many members of the clergy are calling on him to resign, but he is resisting. John Smythe died in 2018, so he never met with earthly justice, at least. This is the Right Reverend Joanne Grenfell, the Bishop of Stepney, speaking yesterday on Radio 4. And my colleague Edward Sturton asked if she thought the Archbishop should resign.
I welcome the fact that the Archbishop made a statement on Thursday, personally apologising for what he described as his failures after 2013 to really ensure energetically enough that this was followed through. He was also very clear that he wasn't aware of the abuse before 2013, and I believe and trust that's correct.
But do you think he should resign?
As I said, I really appreciate that the Archbishop has wholeheartedly apologised for what he could have and should have done differently in 2013. I also recognise his commitment over the time of his tenure as Archbishop to really having tried to change safeguarding. Now, I think there's still an awful lot to do, but I do think that builds on some of the changes that we have seen over the last 10 years.
Yeah, I'm just interested that you can't give me a straight yes or no to that question.
As I said, I support the Archbishop's apology. Okay. I'm glad that he's made it.
Well, let's speak now to Giles Fraser, Vicar of St Anne's Church in Kew. Giles, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So in an article published on the website Unheard, I think it's been published this morning, you detail how you were abused in the church at the age of seven, though not by Smythe. So you've got harrowing personal experience of these issues more broadly. Let me ask you, first of all, about Justin Welby. Has he lost the confidence of the clergy?
He has. It's a terrible situation. I mean, there you just heard a clip from the Bishop of Stepney, who's the church's lead safeguarding officer. She's asked three times if she thinks that he should resign, and she can't say no to it. There's a petition going round now, which many people are signing, and this is from all parts of the church. I'm afraid he's really lost the confidence of his clergy. He's lost the confidence of many of his bishops, and his position is completely untenable.
There's two different things going on here, isn't it? There's, first of all, there's the general view, and I wonder what you think, about whether it seems plausible that someone like Justin Welby, as he says, didn't know anything about these allegations before 2013. And then there's a second bit, which is, what on earth did people do after 2013? So let's take them in turns. Is it plausible that someone like Justin Welby didn't know about Smythe, who had a hell of a reputation?
Well, the Makin report uses the word unlikely. It said it's unlikely he didn't know in the 1980s. And that seems to me to be right. He was in the circle of trust of this group of conservative evangelicals. It was an open and not very well kept secret in this area. A report was published that was circulated amongst conservative evangelicals in 1982. Now, this is extraordinary. And the Archbishop, you know, was on the Christmas card list, exchanged Christmas cards, continued to fund his mission, even when this ghastly man went to Africa and continued to abuse children and young men. It really is. It really doesn't add up.
I mean, I should say it's worth saying the Archbishop says he absolutely did not know. He had no awareness or suspicion of the allegations before he was told in 2013. That's his view. Yeah. I hear what you say about
it. And the Making report says the word, quote, that's unlikely.
And what do you think about what happened after 2013? Because the striking thing is that we know these allegations were surfaced. It became widely known. They were formally declared, as it were. But it was after 2013 that Smythe continued to abuse, as you say, Giles, in South Africa.
And nothing was done about it. I mean, not enough to stop him. I mean, when the Archbishop was interviewed on Channel 4 News, he accepted that he'd been incompetent about this. But I do think it's worse. I think there's a degree of cover-up that's going on here. And it's not just the Archbishop of Canterbury. There's six other serving bishops that are indicated in this report. There's many senior clergy. This is an absolute crisis for the Church of England. And, you know, public representatives like the Church, like myself, and those who've been on the receiving end of something not dissimilar, in my case, it actually wasn't in church, it was at school. But I know what it's like to be in the company of a child, when I'm a child, in the company of a sadist on your own. And the idea that the church is just actually not really doing very much about this is horrendous. And I'm afraid the Archbishop is too culpable and clearly had knowledge about this, even if we argue about it, before 2013, when he was quote-unquote formally told.
Right.
He still did very little, and certainly insufficient to stop Smythe after that period.
Well, thank you for the clarification about your particular experience. Yeah. And you've spoken very openly and powerfully. As I say, people can read your writing about this on the website Unheard. A lot of victims don't actually tell anyone, do they, Giles? They live with this forever, and the trauma haunts them until their final moments.
I find it very difficult. I actually find it very difficult to talk about. I mean, I saw a newspaper article the other day as I was coming back from a meeting, and I sat down and I just had it laid out on the dining room table, and I had a glass of whiskey, and I looked at it and I cried for 2 hours. And I gotta be careful because I'll cry on the programme. But it's very, very traumatic, and it stays with you. I mean, this happened to me when I was 7, 8. I'm 60 in a few weeks' time, and this is over half a century ago, and this stuff stays with you. And the idea that people will continue to be abused after the church knew about what has happened is disgraceful.
What is it about the culture of the Church of England, which of course does extraordinary work and extraordinary good work in so many communities across the country? We shouldn't tar it all with one brush. But what is
I'm a priest in the Church.
Well, of course, people on Radio 4 will know of that and of your reputation, Charles, as a hugely valued priest. But what is it about the culture of the church that allowed so many God-fearing figures to cover up this abuse, this rampant abuse for so long?
There's a number of things. Bishops are too busy. They're too busy spending their time doing a whole range of things, and they've really got to prioritise the Church of England and the needs of the Church of England rather than swanning around the world doing things that feed their egos. I think that's terribly important. They need to concentrate on what's on their desk. I also think there's a sense of sort of all banding together and not wanting the reputation. All this dreadful stuff about reputation management, which is always going to come back and bite you. That's a terribly dangerous thing. And people just, I mean, and there's also something in the church that was very creepy. One of the things that's really there, and it's a particular side of the church, I think. It is a conservative evangelical side of the church. This sort of creepy association between violence and sex. Mm. I mean, John Smythe was obsessed with the sort of masturbation of young men. And this idea that this is sin, that this is the sort of great sin, it's frankly laughable, but it's also sort of twisted. And this really needs to be faced, because there is something, there's something that we really need. This needs to be our sort of like watershed moment in the church, where we look at what's happened. We look at the sort of culture of deference, the way in which so many of our senior leadership play out, and you know, rally with each other to defend each other. The way in which, you know, you don't know, quote unquote, until you've got a report written on it on your desk. There's so much that's wrong here. And the people who suffered, I mean, you know, just the idea that the Archbishop knew in 2013, at the very most generous interpretation, and still people were abused around the world. It's absolutely appalling. Okay. And I think the Archbishop has got, I think he really has to go.
Charles Fraser, really good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning and speaking so openly. Well, let me just, before I give you the Action Line number, in case these issues have affected you personally, let me just reiterate the view from Lambeth Palace. They've released a statement saying the Archbishop reiterates his horror at the scale of John Smythe's egregious abuse as reflected in his public apology. He has apologised profoundly, both for his own failures and omissions and for the wickedness, concealment and abuse by the church more widely. As he has said, he had no awareness or suspicion of the allegations before he was told in 2013. And therefore, having reflected, he does not intend to resign. He hopes the Make and Review supports the ongoing work of building a safer church here and around the world. But if what Giles was talking about there has affected you, if you want to talk to anyone about these issues, give the BBC Action Line a call. It's bbc.co.uk/actionline for the website, or the number is 0800 110 100. That's 0800 110 100.
It is 17:16, rather, just flicked, minutes to eight. Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal. That line from 2001, A Space Odyssey, is the cinematic opening of a new technological era, one where machines not only learn but are revealed to have become sentient. Hal, you see, the onboard computer, is not that keen anymore on his one-time masters, the humans on board. Now a group of scientists have suggested that the masters of artificial intelligence, the tech companies pushing the boundaries back, need to think not just about how much and how fast these machines can learn, but also about whether a moment is coming that through learning, machines, computers, may develop personality, sentience, good and bad moods. They may feel hurt, that humans are or may actually create a new race of beings. Earlier I spoke to Professor Jonathan Birch, co-author of the paper and author of The Edge of Sentience, and I asked him when he started to take the possibility of AI consciousness seriously.
My mind has changed. I think all of our minds should change on this. 4 years ago, I think it was entirely reasonable to dismiss the idea of consciousness or sentience or mind in AI as being a sci-fi idea, as being something that would probably be in the distant future, if ever. But the technology has moved on so rapidly since then that I think that's no longer the case. And in fact, there's a realistic possibility now of conscious AI being with us in the near future.
What does it mean to those of us who don't have computer science degrees? What does it mean for a computer or its programming, forgive me, to achieve sentience?
Well, this is itself a big topic of dispute and debate. We're talking about feeling. We're talking about there being lots of computations going on, just as there are in our own brain. But in our own brain, there's also subjective experience. There's something it feels like. And there's feelings like pleasure, pain, joy, comfort, discomfort, excitement. Consciousness is one of the great mysteries of science and philosophy. We don't know exactly what it takes. And so it raises the possibility that we might end up crossing that line far before we realize that we've actually done so.
So you are, to some degree, sort of raising the red flag and saying, this could happen, be ready for it, and prepare.
Yes, and acknowledge it as a serious possibility. And this is really a message we're trying to send to the tech companies like Anthropic and OpenAI and Google, that they need to be taking seriously the risk that their research might lead to forms of consciousness and sentience without that necessarily being the intention at all.
Are they listening?
I don't know if they're listening. There's been some positive signs from Anthropic and from Google recently, in that some researchers within those organizations have been co-authoring papers on this topic. But as I see it, this is still a very small group. It's still a very small minority in a field that is overwhelmingly not taking this seriously and neglecting the risk and saying it is still a sci-fi idea. And I think that needs to change.
If computers of a certain kind do have sentience, do have feelings, then they are presumably rather close to being what we humans think of as individuals. As, I mean, if not people, then a lot more than very, very clever calculating machines.
We may well be creating minds, yes, conscious minds, and they will be profoundly different to our own. So in a way, they won't be people. There'll be this new form of conscious being that is profoundly unlike anything the world has ever seen before. And I really think we're not prepared for that right now. We're not thinking about these risks that that poses. And so with our work on this, we're trying to start a discussion. We're trying to bring people into that conversation about what it would mean to be sharing the world with another form of highly intelligent, conscious life.
And the call that you and others are making is for the big tech companies that are working with these machines and with their programming, for those companies to be aware of the risk and to build that into their development and their welfare programs.
Yeah, I think we're calling for three things, really. One is for the tech companies to acknowledge these risks publicly, and secondly, to support the research that is needed to monitor carefully for warning signs that this is happening. And thirdly, to try to help society prepare. That could involve funding things like citizens' assemblies through which the public is brought into the discussion. Because I think society is not ready for the changes this is going to bring.
Professor Jonathan Birch, thank you so much.
Well, there's a few thoughts for the day. And in a few minutes' time, we'll hear more about what to expect from the first COP summit in the shadow of the new Trump presidency. But for now, it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Bishop James Jones.
Good morning. On this Armistice Day, it seems trivial to mention Taylor Swift, but she's catapulted to the top of the lexicon, a word that narrowly missed the Collins Prize as Word of the Year. Era. And era is a word for our times, as we remember especially the First and Second World Wars. They were of another era. Not just because of the high tech of today's modern warfare, but because our attitudes are so different from 100 years ago. At a meeting recently, I was asked about how the world has changed. From A to E, I offered five indicators. Authority is no longer accepted as it once was. Beliefs are relative, so we hear not so much about the truth as my truth. Culture seems concussed with little memory of the past. Dictators appeared to deliver greater social cohesion than democracies, and eternity no longer holds us to account. But I wish now that when it came to D, I'd chosen the word duty. Immanuel Kant reckoned it suggested a human capacity for subjecting ourselves to a universal moral law. It's not about deference, but about obeying that law regardless of consequences. But in this era, the demand for rights muffles the call of duty. One of my predecessors as Bishop of Liverpool was Francis Chabas, who lived through the Great War. His son Noel was a doctor and an officer. He was the only soldier in that war to be awarded a double Victoria Cross. The King's citation commended him for his conspicuous bravery and devotion to duty. He was motivated by three things: faith, love for his men, and that sense of duty. He was fatally wounded at Passchendaele in 1917. With his head already scarred by shell splinters, he kept going back into no man's land to tend to and rescue the wounded. He was 32 and engaged to be married. An Oxford Blue and an Olympian with a first-class degree, he had everything to live for. As he was dying, he asked the nurse to get a message to his fiancée. Tell her. Duty called, and called me to obey. On this Armistice Day, would that the remembrance of that word, his last, could sound the bugle on the dawn of a new era, where the demand for our rights would bend the knee to the more noble call of duty.
That was Thought for the Day with Bishop James Jones. The time now is 8 minutes to eight.
The annual UN Climate Change Conference, COP29, is this one, kicks off in the Azerbaijani capital of Baku today. It's already a little knocked about by allegations that it's being used as a shop window for oil and gas companies' investment plans. And of course, it opens with the election of Donald Trump, a man deeply unsympathetic to action on climate change, hanging over it. This is described by some as a money summit, a time to find the cash for poorer countries' mitigation and adaptation to climate change. Lord Sharma, Alok Sharma, as was, is a former COP president. He joins us from the summit in Baku. Good morning, Lord Sharma.
Morning, Johnny.
I don't want to start with a downer, but there is a rather long list of heads of state and government who are not going to Azerbaijan. US, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Is that important? Because a lot of people, I think, would think, well, if they're not going, you're not going to get much out of it.
Look, I mean, I think it is disappointing that we don't have more world leaders coming to this COP. I mean, Keir Starmer is coming, and I think that's it's great. It's showing UK leadership. But what also matters is what all of these countries and the delegations actually announce in terms of the pledges, and also, really importantly, what progress they've made in implementing their existing climate commitments. And ultimately, I mean, those detailed negotiations are led by ministers rather than heads of government. So those ministers are obviously coming. Some of them are already here. So we'll have to see what progress they manage to make.
So is part of what happens over the next few days actually a holding to account of governments for what they've promised before?
I think it has to be a holding of account to governments for what they've promised before. And one of the things that governments promised last year was that they would work to transition away from fossil fuels in energy systems. We've had pushback from some governments during this year. You know, my message has been very clear, is that if you agree to something in an international setting and an international agreement, that is not a pick and mix menu. You agree to everything. Everything's on the menu. You have to deliver that. And of course, the world will be watching to see what every country does at this COP, particularly in terms of explaining how they're meeting their previous commitments.
Of course, the governments that voted to do something last year may not be in office this year, or at least in a few months' time. When you heard that Donald Trump had been re-elected as US president, did you think, oof, that's it? That's a real problem?
Well, I think it had been on the cards for a while. I think people have had a chance to have to think about what happens if Mr. Trump does decide to walk away from the front line in the fight against climate change. Clearly, it will have a big impact, a big shadow on these multilateral climate negotiations. And in fact, you're already seeing that talking to some of the delegates. This is a big, big issue for very many people. If Mr. Trump does walk away from international agreements, I mean, it is going to be a Groundhog Day moment, Johnny, because he did this during his first term and other countries stepped up to take the lead internationally. We certainly did in the UK through COP26, and then we matched that with ambitious domestic agenda as well. So let's see who else steps up. And I think the other point to bear in mind is that, of course, what happens at a national level, federally in the US, absolutely matters. But of course, there's a lot of work going on through businesses, cities, states as well, in terms of tackling climate change. And you're seeing some positive results from that as well. But I don't think anyone can sort of get away from the fact that if Mr. Trump does some of the things that he's suggested, it will slow down the pace of climate change and climate action overall.
Is there a metric of success and failure for this gathering that you will see when you walk away at the end of it?
Yes, I think, I mean, as you said in the introduction, this has been dubbed a finance COP. So basically the world needs to agree a new goal of climate finance, the amount of money that developed governments make available to support developing nations. So we'll see what emerges in terms of a number. I'm not involved in those detailed negotiations anymore. But whatever that public finance number is, it needs to be ambitious, but also demonstrably deliverable. Because I think that's part of the issue that many people have with these gatherings, is that we agree things and we don't necessarily get the delivery on the time that that we've agreed. And that does sap confidence of developing nations. So I think one of the key things that people will be looking out for is that what is the agreement on finance? And the second piece is I hope some countries will also set out and tell us what is their plan in terms of cutting emissions by 2035. I think, you know, we've had in the UK, for instance, the Climate Change Committee put forward a target for the UK. So let's see whether that's something that Mr. Starmer announces.
Lord Starmer, thank you very much for joining us.
On BBC iPlayer.
Asia is home to the most extraordinary life. The largest owls. The world's smallest elephants. The richest seas on the planet. The biggest of all big cats. The world's rarest bear.
Asia with David Attenborough.
If you think you've seen the best the natural world has to offer, think again.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
And now, 2 minutes straight, here's Sarah Keith Lucas with the weather.
Thanks, Emil. Well, we've still got high pressure in charge of our weather, so the dry theme continues, looking pretty settled today and through the week ahead. But the colder, clearer air mass, thankfully, we've got more sunshine on offer. First thing this morning, there's a bit more cloud and drizzle across the southwest of England. That should clear away southwards. And then the high cloud that's with us across the UK will tend to break up. So sunny spells developing, a little bit more cloud drifting in later for parts of Northern Ireland and northern and western Scotland. So after morning mist clears away, there'll be a little bit more cloud here in the northwest later on. One or two showers today for the far north of Scotland, and also you might catch a shower around the east coast of England as well, but they are few and far between. Light winds for most of us away from the far north and east, and top temperatures between about 10 to 12, but we could see 13 or 14 in the southwest. So it's a touch cooler than it has been, but we've got the sunshine to compensate. And then heading through tonight, another clear, dry night. I think mist and fog tonight will be more extensive than it was last night. So some fog, particularly through the Midlands, Wales, Northern England, Southern Scotland and Northern Ireland. Temperatures overnight falling down to about 2 to 5 degrees. So certainly not a widespread frost, but there could be a little bit of grass frost tonight in the north. Into tomorrow then, another day of sunny spells for most of us, but there'll be more breeze blowing in the southeast of England, bringing some cloud and a few showers here.
Thanks very much, Sarah. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Johnny Diamond.
It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 11th of November. The headlines. Donald Trump is reported to have urged Vladimir Putin not to escalate the war in Ukraine in a phone call straight after winning the US election. Sir Keir Starmer is expected to discuss Ukraine and the Middle East during talks with President Macron in Paris before they mark Armistice Day together. We'll talk to the Defence Secretary, John Healey, after the news. A petition has been started by some members of the Church of England's governing body calling for the Archbishop of Canterbury to stand down over a child abuse scandal.
And coming up in the next hour, Chris McCausland, Strictly's first ever blind contestant, talks to us about his groundbreaking performance that got this reaction from the judges.
It's just this message outside of this show that is so much bigger.
You, Chris, don't... I'm getting all emotional. You don't miss a beat. You have no fear.
And is Shakespeare boring the britches off the nation's school children? We'll ask if the English curriculum should focus less on iambic pentameter and more on Instagram posts. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
A clearer picture may be emerging of Donald Trump's approach to the war in Ukraine, with him reportedly issuing a direct warning to President Putin not to escalate the conflict. According to the Washington Post, the president-elect reminded the Russian leader of the sizable American military presence in Europe. Mr. Trump's election victory has raised concerns about the future of the war. He's promised to swiftly resolve it, but not provided any further plans. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports.
There's been uncertainty about Donald Trump's approach to the war in Ukraine, but it now appears discussions started only hours after his election victory. According to the Washington Post, the president-elect spoke to Vladimir Putin on Thursday and urged a speedy resolution to the conflict. Mr. Trump's spokesman hasn't denied the reports, which follow a campaign pledge to end the nearly three-year-long war within a day. Mr. Trump is known to be sceptical about the continued supply of billions of dollars of U.S. aid for Ukraine, but the White House is urging the incoming administration not to turn its back on the country in the face of growing Russian aggression. Joe Biden's national security adviser, Jake Sullivan, said the president would use his remaining time in office to make the case that Ukraine should continue to be granted military support.
The war in Ukraine and any shift in American policy are expected to be high on the agenda when Keir Starmer holds talks with President Macron in Paris. The pair are meeting before attending Armistice Day commemorations near the Champs-Élysées to mark the anniversary of the end of the First World War. Keir is believed to be the first British Prime Minister to attend the ceremony since Winston Churchill joined Charles de Gaulle in 1944. From Paris, here's Hugh Schofield.
It's an important year for British-French relations, with the 120th anniversary of the alliance known as the Entente Cordiale, the 80th anniversary of the Normandy landings, plus since July a new government in London promising a reset of cross-channel relations following the trauma of Brexit. The Prime Minister will start his day with a breakfast meeting with his French opposite number Michel Barnier, a reminder that since the elections in France in the summer, it's not just with President Macron that he has to deal. With the President then at the Élysée Palace, discussions will inevitably centre on European security, Ukraine and the Middle East, and the likely impact of the incoming Trump administration. And after that, there'll be the ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier beneath the Arc de Triomphe, a chance to reflect on the shared sacrifices of the past and their message for today.
Donald Trump has named his choice for what he calls his border czar. He's Tom Homan, a senior immigration official who served in the president-elect's first administration. Writing on social media, Mr. Trump said there was nobody better at policing and controlling US borders, and that Mr. Homan would be in charge of the deportation of illegal aliens back to their country of origin. The Archbishop of Canterbury is facing more calls from within the Church of England to step down over his handling of a child abuse scandal. Justin Welby says he was told in 2013 about John Smythe's abuse of more than 100 children, but Smythe continued his crimes until his death in 2018. Archbishop Welby has apologised, but members of the General Synod have now started a petition calling on him to resign. Reverend Giles Fraser, the vicar of St Anne's in Kew in southwest London, told us the Archbishop had lost the confidence of clergy.
This needs to be our sort of like watershed moment in the church. There's so much that's wrong here. And the people who suffered, you know, just the idea that the Archbishop knew in 2013, at the very most generous interpretation, and still people were abused around the world. It's absolutely appalling. Okay. And I think the Archbishop has got... I think he really has to go.
The details of a new law to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales are expected to be published early this week. The Labour MP behind the draft legislation has said it will be the strictest of its kind in the world. Opponents say the safest law is the one currently in place. Here's our political correspondent Harry Farley.
The proposed legislation is expected to run to more than 40 pages and is being published after lengthy consultation with experts. Kim Leadbeater, the Labour MP for Spend Valley, who's bringing the private members bill, says it will, in her words, contain the strictest protections and safeguards of any legislation anywhere in the world. Of the dozens of MPs I've spoken to, many support the change, but many others have concerns about the impact on disabled people and whether it could open the door to future changes. There are also lots of MPs yet to make up their mind, with some holding open meetings to ask constituents for their views.
The latest UN climate conference is underway in Azerbaijan's capital, Baku. World leaders at the COP29 summit will mainly focus on how much money richer countries should give to poorer nations to help them transition away from fossil fuels. The president of last year's summit in the UAE, Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber, opened the conference, telling delegates that everyone would benefit from tackling climate change.
When sectors work together, we can lift economies and lower emissions. We can make climate and socio-economic progress together at the same time. and we can turn declarations on paper into decisive action on the ground.
The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has said he would be willing to call a vote of confidence in his minority government before Christmas, a step that could pave the way for a snap election sooner than he'd wanted. Opposition parties have been demanding a faster timetable to end the country's political turmoil. In a television interview last night, Mr. Scholz said he wasn't clinging on to his job after the collapse of his governing coalition, adding that if everyone agreed, an earlier confidence vote wouldn't be a problem for him. The Conservative leader, Kelly Badenoch, is likely to be asked about her decision to sack the former chairman of the Post Office, Henry Staunton, when she was business secretary during an appearance at the Post Office inquiry today. The BBC has found that earlier this year she put pressure on Fujitsu, the company that made the faulty Horizon IT system, to provide early compensation. Tom Beale reports.
The government has a compensation fund for wrongly prosecuted post office sub-postmasters, but Fujitsu has also been facing questions about how much it should pay victims. Its European CEO, Paul Patterson, has said the company has a moral obligation to compensate them, though not until after the public inquiry concludes in 2025. The reply to a Freedom of Information request revealed that in March, the then business secretary, Kemi Badenoch, told the firm's Japanese chief executive that an early gesture of compensation would be helpful, but there was no follow-up to this meeting. Fujitsu said it would consider the findings of the inquiry and work with the UK government on appropriate actions.
The trade body Energy UK says a north-south divide in how smart meters work is creating issues for some customers. In parts of northern England and Scotland, people can face technical problems connecting to the network. Without an adequate link, the devices won't work properly and customers can miss out on cheaper tariffs. Zoe Conway has more.
In the Midlands, Wales and southern England, all smart meters use wireless cellular technology, similar to mobile phones, to send data to energy providers. If a signal is not strong enough, it can be boosted by an aerial. But in northern England and Scotland, meters instead rely on radio frequencies and no such fix is available. There are 36 million smart meters in Britain, but 3.5 million don't work properly. The government says it's a legal requirement for energy suppliers to make sure smart meters are working, and it expects them to resolve all issues at a much faster pace.
BBC Panorama's The Truth About Smart Meters is on BBC iPlayer now and BBC One at 8 p.m. tonight. And a project to reintroduce oysters to the Firth of Forth after a century-long absence is celebrating early signs of success. Around 30,000 European flat oysters have been released into the estuary since September last year. Monitoring since then shows there's been a survival rate of 85%. Conservationists say they're delighted by such a positive outcome.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It is now 8:10. President-elect Donald Trump and President Putin have spoken on the phone. We don't know what was said. There were no currently serving officials on the call. But we do know that Ukraine was not told in advance about this phone call, that Mr. Trump has also spoken to President Zelensky, that was last Wednesday, and that Elon Musk was on that call. Mr. Trump has said that he could end Russia's war against Ukraine in a day, though he hasn't explained how. Mr. Putin, for his part, described Mr. Trump as a courageous man. There are reports in American media that outgoing President Biden wants to step up support for Ukraine in his final days in the White House, handing over more financial aid and potentially firing or allowing Ukraine to fire Storm Shadow missiles deep into Russia. Meanwhile, Mr. Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., has taunted President Zelensky on Instagram, sharing a clip posted by Sarah Palin, which includes the words, "You're 38 days from losing your allowance." That's a message to President Zelensky, and allowance is a reference to aid from the US. In a moment, we'll speak to the Defence Secretary, but first, let's speak to James Waterhouse, our correspondent in Kiev, who's been reporting from there and various front lines since Russia's reinvasion of the country. James, morning from London. Just bring us up to date with where we are in this war, James, because we know, we read reports that Russia's taken a huge amount of land. It's advancing at its fastest rate since 2022 in the east of the country. Cities are destroyed and there's a battered power grid that means millions are facing blackouts and a freezing winter. So is Ukraine losing?
Morning, Emil. Yes, for the reasons you illustrate. Now, victory in this war would be defined by Ukraine repelling Russia completely. It is true that The country won the battle for the capital, Kyiv, in the early months of the full-scale invasion. But that has fast turned into an attritional conflict where the objective has become for Ukraine not losing first. And in a war of attrition, size matters, and it is Russia continuing to erode Ukrainian territory. These are incredibly perilous, anxious times for Ukraine. Politically, President Zelensky is still able to stem the growing tide of fear and fatigue over wanting this war to end by keeping his country in the fight. And to do that, he needs the continued support from the US. He would argue more support. It is not known in these parts what President-elect Trump will do next on his pledge to end the war quickly. But what Kyiv is trying to do is mould his thinking. They are trying to pitch to Donald Trump about why Ukraine is worth backing, in the sense of propping up a democratic country, but also in the sense of what a dangerous precedent that could set in the eyes of Kyiv. These are difficult times, and Kyiv would know that Donald Trump would have to engage with the Kremlin as well, and that is what's happening.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv, thank you. Let's turn now to the Defence Secretary, John Healey. Mr. Healey, good morning.
Good morning.
Is Ukraine losing?
Ukraine's certainly under pressure. Russia is certainly escalating. And President Trump has reportedly told Putin and warned him against further escalation. If he's done that, he's right to do so. Russia's escalating with massing North Korean troops on their territory. It's escalating with more than 2,000 one-way attack kamikaze drones aimed at Kyiv and the rest of the Ukrainian cities in the last month alone. And one person is responsible for that escalation, and that's Putin. Our job as the UK and other allies supporting Ukraine is to step up our military aid to put them in the strongest possible position over the months ahead. And that's something that we've been discussing with the US and allies for a few weeks now. I did so a couple of weeks ago at the NATO defence ministers. So there's nothing new. It's a task that we've together done and undertaken for the last two and a half years, and we'll continue to do so.
Sorry to interrupt. You mentioned Mr. Trump. If Mr. Trump does reduce financial support for Ukraine, which he has repeatedly said he'll do, what will the UK response be?
Well, let's see what President Trump actually does when he takes office. It's less than a week since the election. There's still another 2 months to go before he does assume the presidency. In the meantime, you ask what the UK will do. We'll do what we've been doing as a government since July. We've stepped up support for Ukraine. We'll do that further. We've speeded up deliveries of military aid, and we'll do that further. President Zelensky cites us as an example to other countries. And we're now spending more on military aid than ever before, £3 billion a year this year, next year, and as long as it takes, plus a £2.3 billion that we can devote to Ukraine from the frozen assets of corrupt Russian money.
Okay, can I ask you some very specific questions then? We can rattle through these. Just on Storm Shadow missiles, these long-range Anglo-French missiles, are you prepared to give Ukraine more Storm Shadow missiles, yes or no?
Look, I'm afraid I've always said the only person that benefits from public discussion about this is Putin. And as Defence Secretary, I'm not going to comment on operational details.
And is that also your position on whether or not you'd be prepared, were Ukraine to get more Storm Shadow missiles, is that also your position on whether or not you'd be prepared for them to be used at targets deep inside Russia?
Look, in general terms, we're ready to respond to Ukrainian needs. We're looking to, and we are, stepping up support for Ukraine. We recognise the pressure that they're under at the moment, and the risks of recent Russian escalation.
Right, it's just that they have been quoted. I understand your position, of course, common sense. One understands as Defence Secretary why you're sensitive and conscious about what you'd say in public. It's just that the Ukrainian government perhaps is less concerned about sensitivities, and they've been speaking to The Guardian. And on Friday, they said that relations with the UK government under Labour have worsened. They asked for more Storm Shadow missiles specifically, which is why I asked you. And they said, and I quote, a senior government source from Ukraine says, it isn't happening. Starmer isn't giving us long-range weapons. The situation is not the same as when Rishi Sunak was Prime Minister. The relationship has got worse. That's the Ukrainian view. What's yours?
That is simply not correct. We've stepped up with more military support. We've speeded up deliveries. We're now spending more on military aid for Ukraine than ever before as a UK government. And I spoke at length to the defence minister in Ukraine yesterday. He certainly doesn't see the UK support weakening. And he said the Ukrainians are confident in Britain's continuing and Britain's continuing steadfast support for their country.
If this is going to end with a negotiated solution, a political solution, which is what everyone, including you, accept, I believe, why should Vladimir Putin be allowed to take by violent force a single inch of land from a sovereign European democracy?
Look, that's not a call for the UK.
No, of course, but I just want to know what you think.
Ukrainians are fighting. They get to make the calls about when to start talking as well as to fight. Our job is to support them now in their fight to retain their freedom, protect their sovereignty, repel the Russian invasion. And our job, if they decide to talk, is to support them in those talks and the security for the long term. We will do that. And we will continue to do that, to stand by Ukraine for as long as it takes for them to prevail.
Let's turn to the defence budget. I know you're very concerned to make sure the armed forces get the support they need. And in the budget, Rachel Reeves announced an ostensible £2.9 billion increase in defence spending to get closer to the stated aim of spending 2.5% of GDP on defence. You mentioned that £2.9 billion figure a moment ago, I think. But there are a lot of people, Mr. Healey, including former Defence Secretary Ben Wallace, who we spoke to on Saturday, who think that there's a bit of dodgy accounting going on, that what you're actually doing is not providing an extra £2.9 billion. You're just moving money allocated for Ukraine from the Treasury Reserve to the Defence Ministry. So are you providing an extra £2.9 billion or not?
Yes, we are. Ben Wallace is factually incorrect. The £2.9 billion extra next year comes on top of the £3 billion this year, the £3 billion next year for Ukraine, and those figures are set out in black and white in the budget documents, and anyone can go and check them, including Ben Wallace, if he wants to do that for himself.
And the 2.5% of GDP spent on defence, which is a Labour target, will that target be reached this Parliament?
Well, we'll set out that 2.5% path. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury yesterday said you'll see this in the spring. Everyone's agreed defence spending must rise. We've started to increase defence spending already with the extra money for next year. And it's important that we do this because we've got to deal with the rising threats that we face. We've got to deal with this new era of insecurity, and we've got to make our forces better fit to fight, better able to deter those who will do us harm. And that's my job as Defence Secretary.
No one doubts the case for it. It's just when it's going to happen, because you went into the election saying it would happen. And obviously there's a lot of pressure on the public finances. We get that. It's just it could do with a bit of clarity. I don't really understand why we have to wait for spring to work out whether or not the manifesto commitment will be achieved in this Parliament. Because if you didn't achieve it in this Parliament, and I know you're not committing to it right now, that would be a betrayal of a promise that you've made to lots of people, including the armed forces, wouldn't it?
No, since the election, the Prime Minister, the Chancellor and I have all reaffirmed that commitment to set
in this Parliament
2.5% of GDP, a level, by the way, that we haven't seen in the UK since 2010 when Labour was last
in this Parliament. Government.
Well, from the start, we've also said, look, it's a question of how much we spend, but how we spend it and how well.
Yeah, but are you going to get to the 2.5% target in this Parliament?
So the reason that it matters how we spend it, how well we spend it, as well as how much we spend, is that we've got a defence review underway that will report early next year, and that will give us the plan to help deal with the threats we face, the capabilities we need, and how best to make sure that we get the best value for money as we increase defence spending to 2.5% of GDP again.
Sure, I get there's a review going on. I get that you've got an ambition to get to 2.5%, and we hear loud and clear that you think there's a case for it. Will you get to that 2.5% within this Parliament?
We'll set that path, we'll set that plans out. You can expect it in the spring, as the Chief Secretary of the Treasury said. My job's to make sure that we've got a clear plan. We'll spend it well, and we'll increase spending, as everybody agrees we must do on defence, to deal with the threats that we face in an increasingly uncertain world.
John Healey, Defence Secretary, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning.
It is 21 minutes past 8. Now, you may be dazzled by the twirls and swirls on Strictly Come Dancing. The costumes and the light show alone are a pretty good reason to tune in. But spare a thought for one of the contestants, comedian Chris McCausland. He sees none of it because he is, as many will know, blind. But praise has cascaded down upon him for a dance routine on Saturday night that reflected his experience with blindness. 33 points out of a possible 40 is what the judges gave him for this performance.
It doesn't matter where I go, when I speak about Strictly Come Dancing, everybody's speaking about you. It's just this message outside of this show that is so much bigger.
The lift coming out of that poignant blackout moment was absolutely spectacular. You really do not know how you are doing this.
It's the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen in my entire life. You are remarkable, inspiration, all these lovely words.
You, Chris, don't... I'm getting all emotional. You don't miss a beat. You have no fear. You come out every week with your heart on your sleeve and you give us 100% of what you're capable of. And in my book, that's a winner.
Well, we all sign on from John Lennon there. I think most people will be smiling there as they listen to that. Chris McCausland joins us now. Chris, well done. How was it and were you pleased with it?
Yeah, do you know, it was, it's interesting listening back to the comments there because you're a little bit in a world of your own. After the dance, you've got all this release of nerves and relief of getting through it. And then you've got these four guys just talking at you. And sometimes it can sound a little bit like the teachers on Charlie Brown, you know, just kind of just wow, 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 wow. So to hear it back there and, you know, Shirley saying that I have no fear, I think I'm good at masking my fear. Because it's terrifying to do it on live TV when you've got no previous experience of it, you know, and so to get to every week that we get through it and we do a good job, I'm delighted.
Do you know when you finished the routine, do you know that, oh, that went really well, or do you have to wait to hear the comments?
No, so like even when we're training, you're in such concentration in like the steps, and especially on the first couple of days of training, that it's very difficult to even separate the signals to your hands and your arms. You know, I have to say to Diane, I'm doing feet today. We'll look at arms tomorrow. Because as soon as I get my arms going, my feet stop working. So there's such concentration that I often don't know how my frame was until I've kind of done it and I have to ask Diane. And a few weeks ago, we did a waltz and the microphones picked up at the end, me saying to Diane, did I do okay? Mm. And everyone said, oh, wasn't that sweet? I genuinely didn't know.
can we talk about the idea behind the dance on Saturday? Because it was about reflecting the experience of blindness. How did you approach it? How did you talk with Diane about it?
Well, do you know, I mean, obviously, lots of ideas kind of, you see people online and things like that, and they're saying, oh, wouldn't it be good if Diane wore a blindfold and things like that? Not really. No, it'd probably be a disaster, if I'm honest with you. I kind of pitched this idea to Diane of having it as a very kind of brief, a moment, really, rather than something that was, you know, made more out of the idea and became maybe a gimmick, or it wasn't really to put Diane into the dark. It was to put the audience into the dark and really to surprise them so that, you know, what they saw at the end of the darkness was completely surprising and different to what they saw going into it, and to almost make them think, how the hell did they get into that? You know, so we were spinning at quite a speed with her lying across my shoulders. When we went into the darkness, she was standing in front of me and I put my hands over her eyes. So that was the idea, really, was to surprise the audience and put them into the dark.
Has the doing the show changed your understanding of your abilities? Or is it about all of us working out that actually our ideas about your abilities might have been wrong?
So it's a little bit of everything, to be honest. I mean, there's no doubt that we are surprising people, but there's no doubt that we are surprising ourselves, and I'm definitely surprising myself. I said no to this a few times because I didn't think I'd be able to do it at all. It was something I couldn't even go and watch, so it was completely unknown. I didn't know what was expected of me in terms of the standard, what the dances were. And so definitely surprising myself, but also there are quite low expectations of people with disabilities by, you know, quite a lot of people out there in the wild. Into the point where, you know, sometimes you'll come down some steps to a taxi outside and they'll say, oh, wow, how did you do the steps on your own? And, you know, it is people kind of don't, oh, wow, you can use a phone. It's expectations can be quite low because maybe people's ideas of disability can be antiquated or maybe they just got no exposure. So this, in a way, it's quite extreme, isn't it? But yeah. I hope it goes some way to you know, stretching people's ideas of what is possible.
Chris, a great pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much. And for those who would like to see or hear Chris, he is on tour next year if you want to book your tickets.
27 minutes past eight, and Mike Williams is here with the sport. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Amol. Talking rugby union this hour. What a miserable weekend for the home nations. All four of them beaten in a second round of the Autumn Nations series that belonged to the Southern Hemisphere. It all started on Friday with Ireland's defeat to New Zealand. That was followed by that remarkable England-Australia match at Twickenham on Saturday. England narrowly losing that one in the 84th minute. Then at Murrayfield yesterday, Scotland were beaten by world champion South Africa. But the biggest shock of the lot came in Cardiff.
And the Fijians scream in delight. Red shirts collapse to the floor. Wales are beaten. They are beaten for the first time ever in Cardiff by Fiji. Warren Gatland looks to the sky. Wales have now lost 10 games in a row.
Yes, Wales' wretched 2024 continued. Without a win now for 13 months, they were beaten 24-19 by Fiji at home. Well, the former Wales centre, Tom Shanklin, was at the Principality Stadium yesterday and joins us live now. Morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Where do you start then, dissecting that performance from Wales?
Oh, do you know what? It's actually good for me because whenever we play Fiji, people always ring me up about the 2007 loss because that was the last time we lost against them. So hopefully they'll start ringing this new crop of players now for any comments on losses, because look, it was a bit of a shock in terms of how well Wales have played against Fiji in recent times. But if you look at the rankings, Wales are actually below Fiji in the rankings. So, you know, Fiji are classed as a better team. I thought for moments in that game, I thought Wales did pretty well. I thought some of their attack looked pretty good. But as soon as you get into a battle with Fiji, a loose battle, they've got so many good athletes that they just ended up winning that physical dominance.
If we're being brutally honest, Tom, Warren Gatland's second spell in charge of Wales has been incredibly disappointing, hasn't it? Is he in danger of tarnishing his legacy a bit?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it was his decision to come back to Wales when he left in 2019, I think. And I thought that he left at the right time. I thought he took Wales as far as he could. But then after that, we had a bit of a disastrous campaign. And that's just carried on. And that's probably just a reflection of where Welsh rugby is right now in terms of the domestic league. The players coming through, we're not quite there yet. There's quite a lot of youngsters coming through, but losing becomes a habit, and you can see there's just a massive lack of confidence at the moment. I just hope now in the next couple of games they can take some confidence from that, because you know they're in desperate need. 10 games on a losing streak. Do you know what? I played in probably the majority of them that happened in 2002 and 2003, so I've got a lot of sympathy for the players at the moment, but it's tough to pick yourself up and get yourself out of that little hole.
And it doesn't get any easier for Wales, Australia, and then the world champion South Africa next up in this Autumn Nations series. We shall see how they fare. I've got to leave it there. Former Wales centre Tom Shanklin joining us live on the programme. Many thanks. Just to tell you one cricket headline from the Caribbean. Another victory for England over the West Indies yesterday. They won the second T20 by 7 wickets in Barbados to go 2-0 up in the 5-match series. The third T20 is in St Lucia on Thursday.
Thank you, Mike. It is 29 minutes to 9. Start the week is coming up. Here to tell us more is Amanda Vickery.
Good morning. If ever there was a subject that gets the blood pumping in the Christian church, it's got to be sexuality. A new history argues it was ever thus. Temptation and taboo, desire and chastity. Over the last 3,000 years, men, and yes, nearly always men, have passed judgment from the monastery and the pulpit. For women, it's been a long struggle, manoeuvring between Eve and Mary. So today we'll be exploring that history, the revolutions, the continuities, the contradictions, and yes, the pitfalls. Pity the poor Russian Orthodox sect, who fatally mistranslated just one small word and ended with castration rather than a command to be fruitful. Let's start the week looking under the cassock just after nine.
Quick look at the weather, 28 minutes to nine, and I can tell you today we'll see any early cloud in the far south soon diminish to leave a largely dry and bright day. Bright skies elsewhere too, but Scotland will see some areas of cloud, mainly clear and dry for most later on.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Johnny Diamond. Let's get a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Ukrainian officials in the southern city of Mykolaiv say a Russian drone strike has killed at least five people. Air raid alerts have issued across most of the country in anticipation of a potential large-scale attack by Russian bombers. Donald Trump is reported to have warned President Putin against escalating the war in Ukraine. The Defence Secretary John Healey told this programme that if that is what the president-elect has done, he was right to do so. Mr. Healey said the UK recognised the pressure the Ukrainian forces were under and had stepped up military aid. Sir Keir Starmer has been greeted by President Macron in Paris, where the two leaders are expected to discuss Ukraine and the Middle East. They'll then take part in Armistice Day commemorations, marking the anniversary of the end of the First World War. And a petition has been started by members of the Church of England's governing body demanding that the Archbishop of Canterbury stand down over an abuse scandal. One vicar, the Reverend Giles Fraser, told us he had lost confidence in Archbishop Welby and his position was completely untenable.
Thanks, Alan. It's 27 minutes to nine. This week sees a deadline in the conflict in Gaza. The Biden administration has given Israel a hard date tomorrow to get more humanitarian aid into the Strip. The number of aid deliveries collapsed during October, and the White House has said that if Israel does not allow more humanitarian aid in, further military assistance would be thrown into doubt. The situation in Gaza, all man-made, of course, is probably best described as terrible. At the weekend, the World Health Organization said that northern Gaza is at the risk of imminent famine. The Israeli military has urged and instructed residents in the north of the Strip to head south whilst it pursues Hamas fighters, but many have not left. Saib is one of them. And I spoke to him a few moments ago. He lives in northern Gaza, and I asked him about access to food, water and medicine at the moment.
The life here is really, or it's extremely hard. Like, we just live day by day. Like, if you go to the market, you won't find anything. There's no aid trucks coming from anywhere. Life is getting more harder. Like, it's getting really hard, like, for people to keep on this life. The water is kind of, like, thanks God, the water is not that big problem. But the electricity is still a big problem. Like, we suffer to charge our phones. We suffer to get some light at night. Everything here is a challenge, actually. This is the life that we are living now. It's a challenge after a challenge after a challenge. And with all of that, you don't feel safe and you might die any moment. And you might lose someone close to you, brother or sister or any one of your relatives, but you have only, like, unfortunately, I'm sorry to say that, but it's like you have only one day to feel sorry for that. But the next day, you have to get up and start your life, because if you don't do that, you might die and no one will look after you.
Israel has instructed or recommended or told people to leave northern Gaza, hasn't it? And many, many people have left?
Yeah, some people left, but the majority of the people refused to leave. Most of them, like, refused to leave. And now people say that there is no any benefit of leaving to the south, and people in the south actually regret leaving. Many or most of them say that we prefer to die in our land rather than leaving to the south. Because actually, when you go or you leave your home, we prefer to die with honor rather than leaving to just look for safety. I don't know how that sounds, but
Even with all of the Israeli military activity in the north, even with all of that, people are staying in the north.
Yes, the most thing we do is just we go from a place to another place that we think it could be safer, but we're not leaving to the south. And we believe that this is our home, and no one has the right to ask us to leave. We prefer to die rather than leaving, like most of the people think the same way.
That was Saeb, whom I spoke to earlier, who is remaining in northern Gaza. Rosalia Bolan is a communication specialist with the children's charity UNICEF in Gaza. She's in central Gaza. Good morning.
Good morning.
I mean, given that we have this deadline coming up for the resumption of humanitarian aid, can you give us an idea of how much aid has been coming in, to your knowledge, in what, the last couple of weeks? Because we know that October was a terrible month for aid.
Indeed, what has come in just over the past year has been woefully inadequate to meet even the most basic needs of families in Gaza. And what is inconceivable to me is that it has even further diminished over October. My colleagues from the Office of the Humanitarian Coordinator have said that on average, 36 trucks with humanitarian aid have entered Gaza daily in October. And what we see the impact on people directly here on the ground. I've come across mothers who have given birth to babies that are premature. We came across a baby 2 weeks ago in Kamal Atwan that weighed just 1 kg, born at 28 weeks, babies with malformation. And other mothers that I've met who may have given birth to babies who appear to be healthy while they were born, their babies are now malnourished at 6-7 months old because they don't have food for themselves and they don't produce enough milk to breastfeed their children. So there is this continuum of deprivation, really, as a direct result of insufficient supplies coming in. And I also want to stress that it's not just humanitarian supplies that are needed. Humanitarian aid cannot sustain an entire population. It was never intended to support populations across the world in conflict. Populations will always have access to some form of market activity, and it's the commercial sector that can bring dietary diversity, that can bring in dairy and vegetables and fruit, and that's what people need. People can't live off flour and canned food.
Rosalia, have you had any sense that since the United States issued its warning, I think that was towards the end of October, that there has been any increase in humanitarian aid, anything like the numbers getting back to what they were beforehand?
I can't speak to the exact numbers and whether there has been a significant increase compared to last week. Mm. What we know for October and the beginning of November is that it continues to be, as I said, largely inadequate. It's not even a trickle of what is needed. And this is a problem because winter is fast approaching. Temperatures are already dropping. It's getting cold at nights. The rainy season will start. People's shelters are absolutely inappropriate. Whatever they've been able to get their hands on, blankets, towels, is what people have made their shelters of. As you can imagine, the moment it starts raining, those shelters will just become soaked and collapse.
Rosalia, thank you very much for giving us your time. Rosalia Bolan, a communication specialist with the children's charity UNICEF in Gaza. And the Israeli Defence Forces have previously told the BBC in response to criticism that it will continue to act as it always has done, according to international law.
It's 20-9. Shortly before his comprehensive victory in last week's presidential election, Donald Trump went on Joe Rogan's podcast and indulged in a little logophilia.
To me, the most beautiful word, and I've said this for the last couple of weeks, in the dictionary today, and any, is the word tariff. It's more beautiful than love. It's more beautiful than anything. It's the most beautiful word. This country can become rich with the use, the proper use of tariffs.
Well, it's worth adding that Donald Trump's high regard for tariffs goes back decades. How should countries such as the UK respond if Trump does indeed slap tariffs of 10 or 20% on imported goods. Let's speak to Kim Darroch, Lord Darroch, former UK ambassador to the US, and also to Liam Byrne, Labour MP and chair of the Business and Trade Committee. Good morning to you both. Kim, if I could just start with you. What's your best guess, Lord Darroch? Is Trump's threat a negotiating tactic, or will he actually do it?
Well, I go back to his first term, Emil, and he, in his first term, slapped 20% tariffs on all imports of steel and aluminium into the US. He would have gone further, but at that stage, he had some mainstream Republicans, who knows, they might have believed in free trade, who were restraining him. But I think he was going to go big this time, and I think it's not in his mindset to use this as a threat. I think it'll be the other way around. I think that he will put the tariffs on early, and then he will say to countries, well, if you want them lifted, what are you going to do to even up, to rebalance our trade relationship? So I would expect him to go big on this, 20% tariffs on all imports into the US, except from China, where it'll be more like 60 to 100%. And I think it will be quite a challenge for the UK. I don't see any special deal coming for the UK. For Europe, actually, probably going to set off a trade war, you know, more globally.
And how should our diplomatic service be preparing? How are your old comrades in the diplomatic service be preparing?
I'm sure they're busy. I'm sure that they are thinking about how to respond here. And look, it's going to be a really big question for the government, because I think the EU will, as it did back in Trump's first term, will retaliate, and they will put, you know, a series of tariffs on US exports to Europe. And our challenge will be, do we align ourselves with the EU and respond, retaliate, or do we try and do some sort of special deal for the UK? Such as, I mean, there is talk about whether Trump will offer us a free trade deal. I think he may well, because he did again in 2017. But it wouldn't be a free trade deal that would be hugely advantageous for the UK. Okay. Just the opposite, I think.
Well, let's think about what some of the government ministers might do creatively to address this. Liam Byrne, what should we do? Should we impose tariffs in return?
I think if we can avoid doing that, it would be better for our economy. We've got to recognise that, however, that Kim is right to stress the doomsday scenario that we're now confronting. And if Trump does go ahead, that's going to have a really significant impact on economic growth, inflation and interest rates in the UK. And I think the argument that we've got to try and land with the new president's administration is that higher duties mean weaker defences. And ultimately, one of the things that President Trump cares about, possibly more even than tariffs, is America's relationship and security when it comes to China. And there are things that we can do together to strengthen the West's defences against China. We can be bringing together our economic security regimes a little bit closer, for example. That's important, by the way, because it unlocks closer cooperation on things like AUKUS, which is pretty critical to Pacific defence and stronger safeguards against China. And when it comes to Taiwan. So I think there is, if you like, a defense and security cooperation that we've got to have, particularly about how we strengthen our defenses when it comes to China, not just on military technology, by the way, but also on economic security and pretty, issues like forced labor.
Pretty hard sell, though, isn't it? I mean, pretty hard sell. Mr. Trump, you've gone into this election saying you're going to slap 20% tariffs on. You've won the election comprehensively. Actually, why don't you row back on that a little bit, because we'll help you with your concerns about China. I mean, that's a pretty tough negotiating. I know it's not yours, but for the UK government to go into the White House with.
I think it's probably the best card that we've got, is the truth, because really? Ultimately, if there is one argument that you hear more than anything else in Washington, it is about China. And it's not impossible, by the way, that President Xi and President Trump do a deal on trade. You know, as we know that President Trump is a pretty transactional kind of president, and I wouldn't rule that out. But, you know, right now we've got a big conversation to have about strengthening NATO security. We're trying to improve and increase the amount of money that we're spending on defense, but that number is going to be lower if our economic growth is weaker, and our economic growth is going to be weaker if we have tariffs from the United States.
Okay, Liam Byrne, thank you. Can I just go back to Kim Darroch for one final thought, if I may? Kim, just you raised the central question of whether the UK priority is about coming in behind the EU or finding some different position. What's your understanding about what the current thinking is? What would our diplomats recommend about whether or not to align with the EU or not?
That's a very good question. The truth is that I'm not sure that any clear view has emerged from the British government yet. I think Liam's ideas about this being a very transactional president, finding something else to offer to him, are good ones. I think that's the right approach, and you need to go to him and say, this is what we will do for you on this if you want to get these sanctions stopped. The other point I make very quickly is most economists think that sanctions will not just damage the global economy, they'll do serious damage to the US economy. And I think some of Trump's businessmen friends who will be more influential with him, he would say of other governments, well, of course they would say, don't do this. But if businessmen tell him it will damage the US economy, we can get to them and say, you must talk to the president if that's what you think. That may be another route through.
Particularly if it's inflationary and there's no chance that he's going to enjoy inflation. Kim Darrock, thank you very much indeed. And before that, Liam Byrne as well.
It is 13 minutes to 9.
So should we teach significantly less Shakespeare in our schools? Perhaps even none. This is the somewhat heretical view of a leading English teacher, no less. He's penned an article in The Times, which, in fairness, does present a nuanced argument with context aplenty. And he's come in to lay some of that argument out and perhaps even be challenged on a bit of it. It's Freddie Bavistock, who's head of English at Harris Westminster Sixth Form, joins us in the studio. And on the line is Jackie O'Hanlon, Director of Creative Learning and Engagement at the Royal Shakespeare Company. Thank you both for your time and for coming in to you, Freddie. What is the argument you lay out in The Times?
My argument is fairly simple. It's essentially that we're killing the subject. And we're doing so because we're treating our literary texts that we're introducing teenagers to as little stories about morality, about history, and things like that. So when I raise questions about Shakespeare, I mean, if I were to show to you what we're asking our kids to do in school, our young children to do, is to respond to the idea that, for example, Macbeth is a story about a man who changes. No mention of it as a work of dramatic art, as a tragedy. The interesting questions it raises about the use of authority, particularly in Shakespeare's time.
So why don't you ask better questions? Why abandon Shakespeare? Why are you blaming Shakespeare for the fact that someone's asking a silly, immature question about Macbeth?
Well, I'm not blaming Shakespeare. I'm just trying to...
No, not you, but why not ask good questions?
But, you know, I'm one of many teachers. There was a meeting organised by the English Association at the Globe in September. Over 100 teachers came to it and all agreed urgent reform of the English GCSEs is required. Very few people love this. And you look at the stats, what's happening to young people in reading, they're being turned off. So we need to change. And probably forcing them to read an entire Shakespeare play is cramming other things out of the curriculum that might make it more exciting for them.
What could be better than reading an entire Shakespeare play? That's the whole point about being young. I'm going to put let Jackie O'Hanlon make the case against. Jackie, what do you make of the argument that Freddie advances there?
Well, I agree with some of the things that Freddie is saying and disagree with some of them. So I definitely believe that Shakespeare's work remains relevant to young people, and I believe it's an important part of their educational experience. But I believe that because of the work that we do with thousands of young people in state-maintained schools every year. We did a piece of research with 5,500 young people about the value of Shakespeare in their lives, and they told us that when they explore the plays as texts for performance, as actors and directors do, they are incredibly exciting lessons where they get to find out what they think and they get to understand and appreciate difference in other people's opinions, because of course Shakespeare was incapable of telling a story from one point of view. He's always telling a multiplicity of perspectives. So I think the richness of the text, the complexity of the text, does have extraordinary relevance and resonance. I also believe he should be part of an expanded canon where students are getting to explore works from other writers, both classical and contemporary.
But if I may say, Jackie, isn't there a tension within what you say, which is that you twice or thrice use the word relevant? And a lot of people say the problem is that we've got a tyranny of relevance. We're far too concerned with what's relevant. We should just teach a canon. And that's the other word that you mentioned. I mean, do you believe, Jackie, that there is something called the greats or the canon, which is all the best that has been thought and read, and that all children should be invited to participate in that tradition?
I think the canon expands all the time because we are discovering new works and perspectives all of the time. That doesn't mean that I think there are a set of works that are no longer relevant, but I do think that for a young person, what we're trying to do is understand ourselves and the world we live in and each other. That's what great works of literature do wherever, whenever and wherever they were written.
And I should say, Freddie, in fairness to your article, which I've read in the Times, you've got kids, you've given many decades to teaching English. You obviously care passionately about their welfare and about the subject. And the starting point of your column in the Times is really that compared to 40 years ago when you were a student in Oxford, English is being, if you like, it's becoming less and less popular. And that's a problem we need to address, really.
Absolutely, because this isn't really about Shakespeare. This is about change.
I'm being facetious.
I mean, I could tell you a story, which is, you know, when my school had to change its A-level provider, we went out looking to see what we could do. I found it would have been possible for me to teach the same A-level I was taught 40 years ago. So how is that possible that in 40 years, what we're potentially asking kids to do at school has not changed? That just doesn't seem to me right. When you think about what amazing writing has happened in this country in the last 40 years. You know, our creative, I mean, Jack is absolutely right. The canon keeps expanding. We have had so much interesting writing happening in the last 40, 50 years. Why are our young people not being exposed to this and brought on board to the incredible richness and excitement of our literary culture?
Do you have a particular beef with the reforms brought in by the coalition government under the education secretary, Michael Gove?
Yes, I do, because they made a category error. They brought across a concept from the world of science, the idea of a knowledge-rich curriculum, which is totally applicable to the world of science and maths and so forth, and they applied it to subjects like English. English is not a subject in which I have a bank of knowledge I need to impart to my students.
I have an emotional knowledge. I mean, it's...
Yes, but the real knowledge of the subject comes from the student's own engagement with it and what they make of it. And this is my real beef, which is that as a result of that major change made, the way we assess the subject has become mechanical.
But isn't there a danger that you put me in mind of something I think Roger Scruton said in his book Culture Counts, where he described culture as something like, it's not word for word, but something like a precious fund of emotional knowledge, which teaches us not what to think, but how to feel. And isn't there a danger that if you cram the curriculum with things written in the last 40 odd years, you kids lose out on the chance to participate in the best that's been thought and read?
I love the quotation, by the way. I couldn't agree more. But I don't think we're going to cram it with anything that's contemporary. I mean, the question is, can we just simply please make it feel more relevant today, make it more exciting, and by make it more creative, allow that emotional response in. When we're teaching them, you know, Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol for the 4,000th time as a little morality tale about poverty in Victorian London, I mean, please, we all go to sleep.
Well, it's very good of you to come in. You've got to be at school in the next 5 minutes, haven't you?
I'm late for my lesson.
The bell's about to ring. Freddie Bavistock and Jackie O'Hannon, thank you both very much indeed.
It is 6 minutes to nine. Most suggestions for more parkland and better access to that parkland get a warm welcome. Not so in Wales, where a proposal for a new national park in the northeast of the country has received something of a raspberry from some. A play area for townies was the stinging comment from one opposition group. Well, Elwyn Vaughan is the leader of the Plaid Cymru group in Powys County Council, and John Roberts chairs the Clwydian Range and Dee Valley National Landscape Access Committee, and they join us now. Good morning to you both. John, I'm going to start with you, if I could. What difference does national park status bring? Why is it such a good idea?
Well, we think it's a really positive move forward. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity here to bring the Clwydian Range and Dee Valley the additional finance and support that it needs to make a real difference. The national landscape outperforms at the moment in the way that it, with very, very limited resources, manages the Clwydian Range and the Dee Valley and all the visitors that it gives. But we need to be conscious of climate change and the great challenges that are with us on biodiversity and nature recovery, and having the additional resources that are a national park would bring would be of great benefit.
So forgive me, it's about the national park status brings more money, more resources to bear on the land itself, does it?
It does, and it's needed. And national parks, relatively speaking, have less resource now than they used to. Mm. We need to think about that again. Welsh Government needs to think very carefully about how it meets these challenges for the future and restores the kind of parity of funding that there used to be. You know, there was little money around in the late 1940s.
I want to hear what Elwyn thinks about all of this. Elwyn, it all sounds like good news, biodiversity, more resources. What's not to like?
Well, in actual fact, in terms of biodiversity, studies clearly show that there's very little difference between biodiversity within a national park and outside a national park. That's a stark reality of it. And the other thing is, the existing national parks have already had cuts of 42% in their budgets in recent years and are totally not sustainable as things move forward. Having another park will further diminish that pot of money and therefore weaken the activities, not strengthen it. That's the reality on the ground. And many of the duties of national park, such as access and footpaths and things, can be done by local authorities if they're given the resources to do that.
And you are concerned also, I think, about the prospect of, frankly, bringing in more people to areas where the infrastructure may not sustain it.
Well, exactly. You know, it is well known that national parks create honeypots of areas, huge numbers, land in certain areas, create problems in those areas, congestion, etc. And, you know, it ties back to the fundamental question, what do we want our rural communities to be? Do we want them to be living, vibrant places where young people can live and work and stay, have children and establish businesses and things? Or do we want it just to be full of holiday homes, Airbnbs, and a nice, quaint, romantic idyll for retirees to come here and live?
John Roberts, the picture Elwyn Vaughan paints there is not a particularly happy one.
Well, I think he makes good points, and we respect his view. But I think you have to look at it in a different way. I mean, he's pointed out quite rightly the difficulties that they have in some areas in Powys with visitors. And if there was a national park and a better resourced national park, it would enable us to give people the opportunity to enjoy the countryside, which everybody in this country deserves. But with the management and the resources and the ranger teams able to manage those visitors in a better and a more constructive way. Our view in supporting the national park is very much that local communities need to be sustainable, and that would always be underpinning any support that we have for the proposals put forward. And to pick up Elwyn's points on resources, local authorities themselves are in serious financial difficulties and are not able to manage things like public access in anything like the way that...